present. And the first order of business is we need to approve a whole bunch of minutes that are in your packets, members. And sorry, we've gotten a little behind on this. We'll try to keep it up from now on. But we've got one set of minutes from March 22nd, 2013. That was our last hearing before the break. So we need to approve that one. And then we've got we've got our interim hearings. There's one here from October 9th, 2013, November 13th, 2013, and then we've got January 28th, 2014, and January 29th, 2014. Representative Johnson?
Madam Chair, I move to approve all those minutes.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. I know it's a heavy lift. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Okay, thank you. Minutes are approved. All right. Members, we're going to go right into House File 2177, and that's Representative Ward. Welcome to the committee, Representative Ward. And this, the intention with this bill is Representative Ward is going to move that House File 2177 be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce. So with that, Representative Ward, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, guests in the audience. Thank you for hearing this bill. We have some wonderful stories to tell and a lot of good data to share. But I know that we're all really, really tired of winter. And we've got prom time coming up and seed catalogs coming, and we are all very hungry for the sun. But tanning beds is not the way to get it. This bill will prohibit minors from using indoor tanning facilities, require proprietors to hang signage to that effect, and impose some penalties. We'll tell you more about that. But why do it now? Skin cancer is the most common kind of cancer and is largely preventable. The incidence of melanoma, the deadliest form of skin cancer, has more than doubled since 1995 among young women. In Minnesota, more than 1,200 new cases of melanoma are diagnosed every year, and 126 Minnesotans die from the disease every year. Dr. Jane Korn will share a lot of recent data in Minnesota for us. The research has conclusively linked indoor tanning to increased risk of melanoma, especially among children. We're fortunate to have Dr. Deanne Lazovich here from the University of Minnesota today to explain the research and why tanning beds have been classified as class 1 carcinogens, the same class as cigarettes. She will summarize the state data on melanoma and tanning among teens. This effort is coming from our own medical community and is supported by the American Cancer Society Action Network, University of Minnesota Masonic Cancer Center, Minnesota Dermatological Society, Minnesota Medical Association, Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians, Minnesota Cancer Alliance, Melanoma Awareness, Minnesota Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Metro Minnesota Oncology Nursing Society, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota, Alina Hospitals and Clinics, and the Mayo Clinic. Parental permission is not good enough. It doesn't work. The data demonstrate that we're not doing enough. We have a duty to protect children. Tanning beds are in the same class of carcinogens as cigarettes and asbestos. So Dr. Jane Korn from the Minnesota Department of Health is here to help us move this along. Dr. Korn.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jane Korn, and I'm the Medical Director in the Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. I'm here today representing the department and to share with you our concern about the rising rates of malignant melanoma in Minnesota, and especially among young women. As you may know, the department's required under state statute to collect, analyze, and report data on all new cases of cancer diagnosed in Minnesota. We do this through the Minnesota Cancer Surveillance System, or we call it MCSS, our statewide cancer registry. And what we've been observing in MCSS is that melanoma rates are rising as the rates for many other types of cancer are declining. Over the last 5 years alone, melanoma rates have increased by about a third. And when you look more closely at who's most affected, the trend is somewhat alarming. Now, I'm going to refer you to a graph that you have in your packets that looks something like this. No slides. Okay. And this graph plots out new cases of melanoma among non-Hispanic whites ages 20 to 49. And you can see that there's a big difference between the trend line for women, which is the top line around the dots, and for men, which is the lower one. Melanoma rates are increasing in younger women at a rate of about 5% per year and have almost doubled since 1995. Melanoma is now the most common cancer diagnosed among women in their 20s. Now, exposure to ultraviolet light, whether it's from natural or artificial sources, is a major risk factor for malignant melanoma. You'll hear more about the science around this in a little while from the others providing testimony. I also want to share with you some important new data about indoor tanning use among teenagers from the Minnesota Student Survey. This is a survey that asks middle and high school students questions about their activities, their experiences, and their behaviors, and it's administered every 3 years. This is a joint project from the Minnesota Departments of Education, Health, Human Services, and Public Safety. In the 2013 survey, for the first time, the survey included questions about indoor tanning use, since indoor tanning is clearly a source of intense UV radiation exposure. The student survey found that among 11th grade white girls, one in three reported that they had tanned indoors in the last year. And among those 11th graders who tanned indoors, more than half of them tanned indoors more than 10 times. So it wasn't just a one-time thing before prom. This behavior could have serious long-term consequences for these young people. That's really a capsule summary of the data. I think they speak for themselves. But I'd like to conclude by saying, although we couldn't be here today, the Commissioner of Health, Dr. Ellinger, asked me to convey to you his support for this bill. He said, there are enough risks already present in the world. We don't need to add to them for the sake of a tan. Thank you very much. And
thank you.
We'll move on.
All right. Thank you. And I'm not seeing any questions right now, so thank you very much for your testimony.
You.
Next testifier, Rochelle Torgerson.
No.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Rochelle Torgerson. I'm a dermatologist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, and I also hold a PhD in biochemistry and molecular biology. I am here today representing the Minnesota Dermatologic Society. It is a professional organization made up of 238 board-certified dermatologists, residents, and physicians throughout Minnesota. We stand together strongly in support of the Minnesota Skin Cancer Prevention Act. I'm here because my colleagues and I believe this is an important issue for the health of the children in Minnesota. It has the potential to significantly reduce the risk of skin cancer and save many lives in our state. Skin cancer is one of the most common problems I face on a day-to-day basis in my job, and that is simply because skin cancer is so common. It is the most common cancer diagnosed each year. It actually supersedes the combined numbers of lung, breast, colon, prostate, and prostate cancers combined. I provided a handout today. It's a color handout. And my hope in using this is to try to show you how the sunlight or ultraviolet radiation can cause cancer. So this is a view of the sun's rays coming down on a cross-section of the skin. And you'll see highlighted at the top that the two forms of ultraviolet light, UVA and UVB, that are important in this setting, can actually penetrate the epidermis, or top layer of the skin, and reach the nuclei of the cells of our skin.
And Dr. Torgerson, excuse me for interrupting. I just want you to know that our copy for members, ours is not in color,
unfortunately. I'm so sorry.
Sorry, that's our fault, but I just wanted to let members know that they have it in their packet.
Color, yes.
Nevertheless.
When the light comes down, the UVA and UVB, and hits the cell, it actually damages the DNA. Once the DNA is damaged, the cell can no longer regulate its growth. It can grow uncontrollably and cause a skin cancer. Damage to DNA of melanocytes, the cell that causes the color we have in our skin, is actually the most concerning to us. And once you damage the DNA of a melanocyte, you can cause a melanoma. Melanoma is so important because it is our deadliest and most aggressive form of cancer. It can spread throughout the body. Ironically, a tan is actually your body's attempt to protect itself from damage to the DNA of melanocytes. So, when you see a tan, you are actually looking at visible damage of the DNA of melanocytes. The frequency of all the three most common types of skin cancers are increasing, but like I've stressed, melanoma is the one that scares us the most. In the United States, one person dies from melanoma every 57 minutes. That's why the Minnesota Dermatologic Society strongly supports this legislation. Developing skin is particularly sensitive to damage from ultraviolet light, and this damage is cumulative over time. No child should be permitted to purposely expose him or herself to indoor cancer-causing ultraviolet radiation. You've heard it before, but I'm going to say it again because I think it is one of the key things to remember. 5 years ago, so not recently, 5 years ago, the World Health Organization classified tanning beds as a class 1 carcinogen. This is the highest rating you can give something. Therefore, it does not get more bad than this. This is in tow and in line with cigarettes and asbestos. The research is clear. Indoor tanning causes skin cancer. The indoor tanning industry continues to spread misinformation to consumers, including our children. The misinformation is so blatant that the Federal Trade Commission has required them to stop deceiving consumers, stating that the messages promoted by the indoor tanning industry fly in the face of scientific evidence. 2 to 3 million teens tan in the U.S. each year. As you've heard, one out of every three white Minnesota 11th graders tanned last year, and more than half of them did it more than 10 times. What we are currently doing to protect Minnesota teens from skin cancer is not working. Finally, preventing skin cancer can have a significant fiscal impact, as currently we spend nearly $4 billion per year treating skin cancer in the United States. I speak here today for my colleagues and myself, but I also speak for my patients that are not here. I specialize in women's dermatology. Therefore, I treat many women in their 20s and 30s with melanoma. Just in the last 2 days, I saw 5 of them. Although each of these women is unique, their stories too often share a common theme, in that there is a history of indoor tanning use starting in their teens. These women believe their melanomas can be attributed to their indoor tanning. They also wish, beyond anything else, that they could go back in time and undo those visits to the tanning salon. And I do too. Much of the melanoma and death from melanoma I witness, I believe, is preventable if we keep kids from developing the tanning habit. The Minnesota Skin Cancer Prevention Act provides the opportunity to help reverse the currently deadly cancer trend. The association between tanning and cancer risk cannot be denied. Please join the medical community in protecting our children by supporting this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Torgerson. Thank you for being here. Questions from members? Okay, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I got to apologize. I stepped out to meet some neighbors of mine who are here specifically with interest in this bill, so their timing was excellent. My question I had, and I hope I didn't miss it, is the comparison of the impact of the tanning bed versus just being out in the middle of the summer and tanning that way.
Dr. Torgerson.
Madam Chair and Representative, you actually did not miss it. There is a difference in the dosage you receive, so to speak, during a period of time. So we acknowledge that ultraviolet radiation, whether it is natural and coming from the sun or artificial and coming from a tanning bed, both of those types of ultraviolet radiation can lead to skin cancer. The problem with the tanning bed is that it is doing it with 5 to 6 times the strength, and it's an unregulated dose, basically, that you're receiving.
Representative Johnson, anything further? Okay. Other questions? Okay, not seeing any right now. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Deanne Lisovich, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Madam Chair, representatives, my name is Dr. Deanne Lisovich, and I'm a cancer epidemiologist and associate professor at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. I'm also a leader in the Cancer Center's Cancer Prevention Research Program, also at the university. And I've studied the issue of indoor tanning and health risks for nearly 15 years. Today I'm here to present the science that supports the proposed legislation to prohibit indoor tanning among minors in Minnesota. From 2004 to 2009, with funding from the National Cancer Institute, I conducted the largest and most detailed study to date on the link between indoor tanning and melanoma, right here in the state of Minnesota. Melanoma, as you've heard, is the most deadly type of skin cancer. The results from our research were clear. We found that lifetime use of indoor tanning in the Minnesotans who participated was very common. And for indoor tanners, the risk of melanoma was about 74% higher compared to non-tanners. Our study established a dose response. People who frequently tanned indoors were 2.5 to 3 times more likely to develop melanoma than people who never tanned indoors. We found that risk of melanoma was increased regardless of the type of tanning bed or device that people used. These beds and booths were primarily located in tanning salons, the sole source of indoor tanning for 86% of the indoor tanners in our study. Indoor tanners, especially women, were starting the practice at younger and younger ages. The age when indoor tanning is initiated is important in two ways. First, the younger the person is when they begin tanning indoors, the more exposure to ultraviolet radiation they can accumulate over time, thereby increasing their risk of melanoma. Second, we found that persons whose melanoma was diagnosed before the age of 30 were actually almost 7 times more likely to be indoor tanners than persons without the disease. We found indoor tanning increased the risk of melanoma located on the trunk of the body in both men and women. This is important because typically women would have less sun exposure than men due to keeping covered when playing or working outdoors. But in fact, national data now show that melanoma is increasing more rapidly among young women than men, as we've also heard in Minnesota, and it's most commonly found on the trunk in young women. Our results were published about a year after the International Agency for Research on Cancer declared indoor tanning to be a human carcinogen. Our study has added to the weight of the evidence because we were able to document the link between the amount of indoor tanning and the risk of melanoma. We were also in our study able to measure the risk factors, the risk of melanoma from indoor tanning after counting for other risk factors for the disease, such as skin color, hair, eye color, sun exposure, previous sunburns. So the results from our study represent the risk of melanoma for indoor tanning above and beyond the influence of these other factors. A summary of 27 studies published since 1988 show that indoor tanning use before the age of 35 increases overall risk of melanoma by 59%. And with each session of use, an individual increases their risk of melanoma by 2%. Thus, if a teenage girl tanned twice a week for a year, a common practice to maintain a year-round tan, she would double her risk of getting melanoma in the future. In summary, the scientific evidence that indoor tanning is a cause of melanoma is strong and convincing. Based on the evidence, 14 countries and 6 U.S. states are now protecting our children from unnecessary UV exposure by restricting access to minors. And it's time for Minnesota to do the same by passing the Minnesota Skin Cancer Prevention Act. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? All right. I don't see any right now. Thank you. Megan Ramey. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Megan Ramey, and this is my mother, Pam Sievert. We are here today to speak in support of the Minnesota Skin Cancer Prevention Act. 4 years ago, I never would have imagined I'd be speaking to state lawmakers today. But 4 years ago, I never would have thought I'd be battling stage 3 melanoma. As a teenager, like so many others, I wanted a healthy glow before special events like prom and vacation. I was also a competitive figure skater, so I tanned before skating events as well. I did not want to be the girl whose complexion blended in with the ice. The area in which I lived had a tanning salon at the end of my street, so tanning was easily accessible to me. At the time, I had no idea the risk I was taking, and neither did my parents. We thought it was okay to tan once in a while. After all, the majority of girls in my high school tanned more than I did. Plus, the salons assured me I was tanning the safe way by monitoring my time in the beds and building a tan gradually over time. I knew tanning could put me at risk for skin cancer, but I honestly thought skin cancer was no big deal. To me, skin cancer was a lesion on your skin easily removed with minor surgery in a dermatology office, the cut it out and forget about it type of thing. I also thought skin cancer was something I would possibly deal with in my old age, never in my 20s. I never knew there was a type of skin cancer called melanoma, and that it is much more serious and even fatal. At age 20, when I was a student at Mankato State University, I noticed a mole on my lower back that bothered me. It was itchy, tender to the touch, and would bleed. I went to the local urgent care center, but they didn't seem to think the mole was anything to be concerned about. Bleeding and irritation continued for a few months until I was able to return home and have my general physician take a look. Immediately, my doctor wished to remove and biopsy the lesion. It would only be a few days before she called me with the results that I had melanoma, the most deadly form of skin cancer. I had a wide excision of skin removed, lymph nodes tested, and a full-life lymph node dissection of my upper right groin area. After surgery, I began a one-month high dose of interferon treatment, which, by the way, cost $40,000. Thank goodness I had good insurance during that time. The cancer has been removed, and I have been labeled NED, or no evidence of disease, for a full 3 years now. But because melanoma has such a high reoccurrence rate, I take weekly injections of Cylitron, or a pegylated interferon, to help reduce my chances of disease coming back. If the drug proves effective at keeping my melanoma at bay, I will remain on it for 2 to 5 years total. Beyond this point, it just remains in hoping and praying that it does not return. I'd like my story to be a cautionary tale to other young people. A tan is not worth risking your life for. I wholeheartedly believe that if tanning beds are restricted to those age 18 and older, it would send a very strong message to just how dangerous this behavior is. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And did you want to speak as well?
Yes, thank you. My name is Pam Sievert, and I am Megan's mom. And I thank you very much for listening to us today. As a mother, I thought I was doing everything that I could to keep my daughter safe. She was a good student. She had good friends, and she had wonderful opportunities ahead of her. I had no idea the risks involved in tanning. I knew skin cancer was caused by too much sun exposure, but I assumed that that was later in life and that skin cancers were easily removed. I come from a generation of sun worshippers who spent hours outside in a lawn chair covered in baby oil and trying to soak up as much of the rays as possible. People my age are now starting to see the effects of their poor choices, but I never thought I would have to see my daughter deal with the effects at such a young age. Some tanning salons even advocate that using tanning beds is safer than laying out in the sun. Now knowing the truth about UV exposure and tanning beds, I believe that prohibiting children from using tanning beds would be a huge help to parents. We assume that our consumer protection laws protect us. We would like to think that tanning would not be allowed for our children unless it was proven safe. We appreciate age-restrictive laws that protect our children from cigarettes and alcohol. And much like a curfew law, this law will support parents in our daily efforts to keep our kids safe. As a parent who wishes I had known better, I ask you today to protect other children and to educate parents by voting for the Skin Cancer Prevention Act. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Any questions from members? Okay, I'm not seeing any. Thank you for coming, though, today.
Thank you.
You know, it's as a mom of a young 20s daughter, it's really striking.
It makes it very real.
Makes it very real. It does. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Is there anyone in the audience who would wish to testify for or against this bill? Anybody in the audience who wants to add to what we've heard today?
Thank you.
And any questions from the members? So I see somebody back there. Do you want to? If you want to testify, please come down. And Representative Abler has a question. Do you want to ask that now, Representative Abler?
I'll wait till the testifiers are done.
Madam Chair, we do have an amendment.
Oh, you have an amendment. Okay.
Author's amendment. We can do that afterward.
Okay. All right. Welcome to the committee, and just please give us your name and go ahead.
I'm Victoria Helene from the City of Princeton.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Victoria Helene, City of Princeton.
Victoria, and how do you spell your last name?
H-A-L-L-I-N.
Okay, thank you.
Please. And I'm here to support this bill. I hope it does pass and that all of Minnesota does support it as well. We just went through a scare with my niece, cancer. Same thing, she's 24 years old and did very little tanning in the tanning beds, but she did do that. And so we feel that may have inhibited what happened to her when she got it and it was on her face. So I just want to say to everybody here that strong support for this bill will protect our children, and I'm an advocate for the children in my community as well as the children across the state and across the country. And I hope with us passing this, and if this bill goes through and does get passed, that other states will do the same thing. You know, we'll follow suit because there's a few of them out there, and I would like to join that effort in supporting this bill. And that's what I would like to share with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming forward. Representative Abler?
Well, thanks, Madam Chair, and I'm glad you asked for testifiers. No one's lobbied me much on the opponent side of this, but I'm just surprised that nobody came to speak against, like, the tanning people, because there were some serious comments that were raised about that. But that's hopefully they know what we're doing here today. But I just wanted to offer a comment to the bill. I hope people don't think this is going to suddenly cure cancer in Minnesota. I was looking at the old law, which was written in 2003. And if it's bad for a 17-year-old, it's bad for an 18-year-old. And if I was looking at the warning labels that are still going to continue, which are extremely lame, and they say warning it ultraviolet radiation, you know. If you read the what the warning signs are, they're very light. When I read that, it's not like the cigarette warnings have gotten stronger and stronger, warning this can cause cancer. The old ones were, you might, you know, be sad if you something bad could happen to you, but now they're much stronger. And so if you're going to try to reform this area of law, I think that you would do well to be a little, you know, go back and look at all of it. And in the section 325H03, it talks about standards for equipment. They were last updated in 1993. And so maybe there are best practices. I don't know, but maybe 3 minutes is the right time and not 15 or whatever. I mean, so, I mean, for the people of Calm, I respect your concern and what you're bringing forward, but I don't think it's going to do as much good as you think. And so I would suggest, as this people work with this some more, that they look at the old law, which is 1993, and really do some good, and put a label that really is meaningful to people that will, you know, the Cancer Society is big on education. There's no education here at all. It's just prohibition. And so there will be some kids who want to break the law and will sneak in with their friends after hours at tanny beds, and you won't have helped them at all. They just have a chance to rebel. So I hope that this helps somebody, but I think it needs more work. So thank you.
Okay. Representative Ward, did you have, you had an amendment?
Yes, let's do this first. Would be an oral amendment, page 2. Line 2.9, just a clarification. After the word equipment, as defined in subdivision 6 of the current law. Yeah.
Okay.
So we're going to insert the words after equipment, insert as defined by subdivision 6 of 325H, the current law.
So I guess I would ask staff, I don't know who would have worked on this, but is that Ms. Olson? Is that language acceptable?
Madam Chair and members, just 1 moment while we look at the current law.
Yeah. While we're I'm asking staff to just make sure the language is correct. But did you want to sort of explain to us what you're doing here exactly, Mr. Schaefer? If you want,
yes,
to introduce
Madam
yourself.
Chair, for the record, my name is Matt Schaefer. I'm with the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. This proposed author's amendment comes in response to really conversations we've had with the American Tanning Association. They indicated they'd be supportive of our bill, but just wanted to make sure that the definition of tanning equipment was tied back to Subdivision 6, which is current law, so you're not capturing other products out there, such as the spray tan. And I have the definition in front of me, and I'm happy to read that for the committee if that's helpful.
Okay, maybe while staff is working on checking that also, I'm getting the okay here. Okay, so that language is fine, and so... did you want to, Ms. Olson?
Madam Chair, we just want to clarify that it is section 325H01, subdivision 6.
Okay.
Notice of consumer. Yeah.
So could you, Ms. Olson, could you just read us then exactly what the insertion would be in the language?
Yes, Madam Chair. After equipment in line 2.9, we'll read as defined in section 325H.01, comma, subdivision 6.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Mr. Schaefer, go ahead.
Yes, Madam Chair. Matt Schaefer. And the definition as written in subdivision 6 is tanning equipment means ultraviolet or other lamps and equipment containing these lamps intended to induce skin tanning through the irradiation of any part of the living human body with ultraviolet radiation. So we're specifically going after the tanning beds. That's the intent.
Okay. And Mr. Schaefer, and then you said that this was made the bill acceptable to the group that represents these owners of these tanning parlors?
Could you tell us that again, please?
Madam Chair, yes, I've spoken with the American Tanning Association, and I believe they might have somebody in the room who may be willing to testify, who've indicated that this language would help, would make them supportive of the bill, and I believe they're on the way down now.
Okay. All right. Only if they care to. We don't need them to, but we can take your word for it if they're in the room and they're. Okay. All right. In the meantime, members, any other questions or? Oh, and so we need to. I'm sorry. We need to actually adopt the oral amendment. Was the question to the amendment?
No, ma'am. It wasn't.
Okay. So let's just. Representative Ward moves that oral amendment as has been stated. Does anybody have questions or comments to that oral amendment? Okay. In that case, all those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay. Thank you. That prevails. Representative Abler. Albright.
Thank you.
Late night last night. Sorry.
I feel like I've been here for a while. This would go to the author of the bill. And I'm just curious, since we're amending the prohibition for minors, much like we would do for purchase of cigarettes or for alcohol, I'm just wondering from an enforcement procedure how you would intend to regulate and oversee the tanning salons for noncompliance.
And just Representative Albright, this bill is going to go to Commerce, and I think that that kind of enforcement would be more relevant in that committee. But Representative Ward, if you have a brief answer to that.
A very brief answer is simply that the signs must be in place. And there is the potential for spot checking, as there is with selling cigarettes and alcohol, to do sting kinds of things. But that's easier to do if the sign is there or not. You just walk in and see that. And it will be up to local law enforcement to enforce this. Okay. Just as it is with tobacco and alcohol.
Okay, so to the testifier, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Valerie Jarek, and I'm the lobbyist for the American Tanning Association. We are supporting this bill. We agree that children under 18 probably should not be using this. In Minnesota, the law currently says that if you're under 18, a parent has to sign for you and give you permission to use a tanning facility. So I would guess that the compliance checks would be similar to what they're doing now, and I don't even know what that is. But it's not a big change from what we're currently doing. The number of clients who actually use the tanning facilities is very low for under 18 in Minnesota. So we do agree with the bill. We're fine with it the way it is. We appreciate the American Cancer Society working with us to make it exclusive to tanning beds and UV radiation and not to the sprays and the lotions that are currently on the market. That we're not representing those people. So,
okay, thank you very much.
Madam Chair,
yeah.
I'd like
Senator Ward.
I'd like Matt Schaefer to make some additional comments, please.
Okay, and in the meantime, also, I just want to say there's a question about who does the enforcement, whether the Department of Health does the enforcement. So I'm going to just put Mr. Koppel on notice. I'm going to ask him if he can to answer that question, or maybe Mr. Schaefer can answer it, who does the enforcement. But go ahead, Mr. Schaefer.
Madam Chair, again, for the record, my name's Matt Schaefer. And the one comment I would say to Representative Abler, we completely agree. I believe this is an incremental step. This is the beginning of a longer conversation. As Drs. Torgerson and Dr. Lazovich indicated, we're seeing a significant spike in melanoma diagnoses, and this is really just the first step in really trying to get those numbers down. And so, there are public information campaigns out underway. There's work that our organization is doing. There's work that the Department of Health is doing, the CDC as well. And so really, we're doing everything we can to get the word out, but it is going to take a lot of work, and this is just one step. In terms of enforcement, what we did is we went back to the current law, Madam Chair, and right now failure of compliance would be a petty misdemeanor. Now, the new language that we're putting in under The third section really gets a little more prescriptive on the fine levels. So it'd be a $150 fine for the first offense, and it would be a $300 fine for each subsequent violation. And I know this isn't the public safety committee, but I did want to kind of point out that $300 number is significant because that's the maximum amount that one can fine under a petty misdemeanor.
So, Mr. Schaefer, just to continue and kind of confirm what you're saying. So this enforcement is done by local law enforcement. It's not done by the Department of Health. This is not like a licensing thing that goes through that department, correct?
Madam Chair, to my knowledge, that's correct.
Okay, and Mr. Koppel is nodding in agreement. So, okay, thank you. Okay, I think if there are no further questions, and I'm not seeing any, I think we're ready to vote on the bill. And so Representative Ward renews her motion that House File 2177 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you very much. Okay, next is going to be House File 2408, Representative Newton. And just as people are leaving, we need to move on with the work of the committee. So I would ask you to please take your conversations out into the hall and please leave as quietly as possible. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I'd like to present House File 2408. If so, I can have someone move it.
Yes, Representative Newton. I will move that House File 2408 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 2408 is the 5% campaign bill that provides a 5% rate increase for home and community-based services for older adults and people with disabilities. I'm very grateful that this bill and clone bills have now have more than 80 House authors. I don't think I've ever seen a bill move like this with so much work and so many authors on a bill. It's nice to carry bills like this. Caregivers, advocates, people receiving services in their families, and service providers are also grateful for so much support in the legislature. 123 community organizations support this bill. Those organizations are listed in the handout that you all have. With me today are the co-chairs of the 5% campaign, Steve Larson, who's the Senior Policy Director for the ARC Minnesota, and Steve Pikarski, who's the Associate Vice President of Older Adult Services for Lutheran Social Services of Minnesota. Other testifiers will talk about the importance of a 5% increase in their lives. Why is this bill needed?
Representative Newton?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. You mentioned a handout, and I don't think we
have it. You don't have it?
No. If you can, if you've got that, we can ask the page to copy it.
Okay.
No.
We'll get that.
Okay.
It's basically a two-page list, Madam Chair, of all the organizations that support this bill.
Okay.
This bill is needed for the following reasons. First and foremost, it's about quality. Quality care for older adults and people with disabilities. Quality care that is provided by consistent and a well-compensated core of caregivers. Reducing staff turnover because of low wages is critical to quality care. Quality of life that enables people with disabilities and older adults to make choices that allow them to live more independently and be part of their communities. And a rate increase for home and community-based services is the major piece of business left over from the 2013 session, where we appropriated only a 1% increase, and that doesn't take effect until April of this year. Excuse me. Providers and their caregivers have received a net increase of only 3.4% since 2003, while inflation has gone up by 24.5%. Caregiver wages and benefits and providers' abilities to stay on top of their costs have lagged way behind the cost of living, causing high caregiver turnover and extreme pressure on providers to maintain stable businesses. Minnesota is a leader in providing quality services to our most vulnerable citizens, and this bill is desperately needed to maintain that quality care. In essence, this bill provides a partial catch-up in providing those quality services. The bill acknowledges the extraordinary work of caregivers. Their daily work ranges from complex services with medically fragile people to the most intimate of care, like toileting, to services needed for daily living like job coaching, transportation, and meals. What's in the bill? It provides a 5% rate increase effective 1 July 2014 for 17 home and community-based services. These include the disability and elderly waivers, ICFs and DDs, assisted living, day training and rehabilitation for people with developmental disabilities, PCAs, in-home care, and home-delivered meals. Providers receiving the increase are required to spend 75% of their new funding on staff compensation. Providers would have the flexibility to use that money to reward and build their caregiver corps, as many caregivers have devoted their years to their jobs and some are relatively new. Providers must develop a plan on how they will distribute the funds, post that plan for all employees, and have it available for the commissioner. The remaining 25% can also be used for caregiver compensation and training, but is also needed to maintain stable and safe operations and pay for every ever-increasing fixed prices, such as fuel and insurances. Steve Larson and Steve Pikarski will go over the whys of this bill, and I don't know who's going to start. One of the Steves.
Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Steve Larson. You have to have a Steve in order to be a co-chair here. And I'm the Senior Policy Director for the ARC Minnesota. And I just want to highlight who benefits from House File 2408. Quality care and quality of life for 6,600 Minnesotans with disabilities and 24,900 older adults will be affected, and 90,880 caregivers will see increases, many for the first time in 5 years. People receiving services will have enhanced choices to create the lives they choose and be more independent in our communities. Caregivers, direct support professionals, now often work two or three jobs to support themselves and their families. And because of low wages, many are forced to leave their jobs for other work, and we've heard testimony about that in the past. We cannot afford to lose these highly skilled workers. Families and people receiving services say over and over again that high staff turnover is the single biggest threat to quality care. Having consistent staff who know the individual needs of people they support is at the core of quality of care. A 5% rate increase in 2014 will help caregivers support their families and continue as caregivers for our most vulnerable people. This bill will help reduce staff turnover. All Minnesota communities will be enriched in keeping with the Olmsted decision as people of all abilities participate more fully. Finally, our state benefits. Home and community-based services are much less expensive per person than providing services in institutions. And I'd just like to conclude that I volunteered to be co-chair, even though our organization does not specifically benefit from the 5% campaign. But those people that we advocate for with intellectual and developmental disabilities and the services they receive will benefit, and that this 5% campaign is long overdue, and we strongly urge you to support House File 2408.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Mr. Pikarski?
Yes, thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Steve Pikarski, and I'm the Associate Vice President of Older Adult Services at Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. I'm also the co-chair of the 5% campaign. Today I'm here to support House File 2408 and the critical need for a 5% increase to community-based services that support older adults and their families. House File 2408 impacts 25,000 older adults who receive assistance and the 90,000 caregivers that provide high quality care in order to help older adults remain in their homes and communities for as long as possible. Community-based services for older adults are a broad array of services that help them continue to live a healthy and independent life in wherever they call home, whether it be an apartment, their own home, an assisted living, or living with a family member. A few of the ways an older adult could receive services would be through a senior nutrition program, which provides either home-delivered meals or congregate meals, or through a senior companion support, which is a stipend older adult volunteer who takes the older adult they are caring for to doctor's appointments, grocery shopping, or to socialize. Or lastly, through supports like caregiver respite. This service allows for family members to get the much-needed break they need. These critical care needs should be provided by consistent and trusted staff. Addressing turnover and wages will help to maintain the workforce with the capacity in both size and ability to meet the needs of older adults in the future. As Minnesota demographics continue to change, age trends will transform the state. The demographic transformation will increase the need for quality community-based supports, and the 5% rate increase will help to ensure that life in the community remains the first and best option for older adults. It is estimated that the use of community-based services instead of institutions saves approximately $31,900 per year. Even with good planning for retirement, two-thirds of older adults still need some form of assistance to go about their daily lives. Community-based providers represent a critical area where capacity needs to be maintained and expanded in the short term to meet the demographic need, and by doing so will save significant public dollars in the future. When older adults have community-based services to help them remain active members in their community, they age well at home longer. This is why a 5% rate increase is critical to Minnesota communities to move Minnesota back on track. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Any questions at this point from members? Okay. Not seeing any. Thank you very much. And we have Rosie Moriarty. Then after Ms. Moriarty, we've got Daniel Pekonen and Annette Greeley. If you could kind of be ready to come down when it's your turn, that'd save us a little time. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Rosie Moriarty, and I'm here sort of in a bunch of different ways. I'm a mother of a 38-year-old son with Prader-Willi syndrome who was never supposed to live past 6 months. He has achieved everything. He started to walk when he was seven. He uses sign language, and he is also working in the community at this time, even though he doesn't speak. I am here as a nurse who works in the field. I am here as a direct care professional, and I am here as Melanie's roommate, caregiver, and friend. Melanie was going to be with me today, but we had a transportation problem, and so we couldn't get her here. But she did send her speech that she was going to read to you, so I'm going to read that with your permission. Hello, my name is Melanie Kett. Now, this is not the face of Melanie Kett. Melanie Kett has a much broader smile, very red hair, very energetic. I am here to talk about me. I was a concert violist. I worked for the St. Paul Symphonic Orchestra. I have MS and can no longer play. Now, Melanie will give you a very sad face. I live in my home. Rosie came to be my housemate to help me stay in my home. She is my friend, caretaker, vacation planner, job coach, and nurse. I want you to understand that I want to live in my house and have care in my home always. I love having friends over and my family to entertain. I love throwing tea parties, and I love showing off my collections of Betty Boop. I support the 5% increase. It is needed to keep people in their homes. Now I will let Rosie talk. And that's from Melanie. And this is from me. My son was born in 1975. At that time, they were still pushing institutionalization. I was told not to become attached to him and just put him at Cambridge State Hospital. That I could not do if I was only going to have him for a short while I was keeping him. In his lifespan, we started with the help of PACER. We started the school program. My son was one of the first children to enter into the school program at the age of four and go through from kindergarten through 12th grade and graduating. He was a first. He also went into a two-year transition program to learn trades. And when he was 17, I had to make the heart-wrenching decision to place him into a different setting. He could no longer stay with me as a single parent. I had had some health issues, and he had taken off at me three times in the night in 1 month. And That is because he only sleeps 2 hours a day, and I was working a full-time job taking care of him, and I was going to sleep instead of staying awake with him. So his first placement started. I worked in the field already. I had already been working in group homes, ICFMRs, and I knew some of the problems in these homes, so it was really scary for me to place my son. It was 2 years of crying at night and always wanting to check on him. But he made it through, and we've had some wonderful placements. He has been with Catholic Charities now for 14 years, but it has not been free of problems. We've had over 100 abuse things that have been filed. We had an involvement where a police officer came and handcuffed my son and put him in the car because the new staff that was trained did not understand when he pulled on his shirt, it meant I want to talk to you. So I'm going to talk about quality of care. People who choose this as a profession, who come into their homes, my son's home is his home, he's been there for 15 years. I, who chose to share my living experience with Melanie for the last 9 years, we are professionals. We also have to be trained. We have to feel that what we're doing is essential to helping this person and their care. We have to know how to get them involved in their community because community involvement is so important. With that, it also means transportation. Melly and I generally can go everywhere together. Today it was just a car failure thing, but she was at the Capitol yesterday rallying. She has made trips out to Wyoming. She has made trips to Washington, D.C. She has made trips to New York, and we have did it with friends, and we have did it solo. But these are her dreams, and my son has dreams, and everybody that lives in these group home settings, they have their dreams, but they have to have staff that know how to read them and to read their dreams. They have to understand that that everybody has a personality, and even though they can't speak it all the time, they can do it. I believe that this bill is so important because it will give agencies a chance to work on things that they have not been able to do. Community involvement, programs in the home like iPads, stuff that they can use. Transportation, there are some homes that don't even have transportation for their clients. All of this stuff is needed and can be helped through this bill. Wages, yes, wages are a problem, and sometimes I think that the biggest problem is that you don't feel like a professional if you're not going to be paid a little above minimum wage. Is there any other questions for me?
So, questions, Representative Benson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a series of questions, and I guess I'm one of those who hasn't signed on the bill because I did have some questions about it. And I'm just curious as to, maybe I ought to know, but how was the decision to settle on a 5% increase? Was it because of budget constraints this year or what? And the reason I'm asking that is when you think about the cost of living each year, it's running somewhere between 2 and 3%, I suspect. That is an effective increase in purchasing power of only about a couple percent, which is really rather paltry, I think, in if we're trying to get up to the purchasing power that people had a number of years ago before the state was cutting back on providing resources for nursing homes. So I'm just wondering maybe we could get a little background on how this 5% number was arrived at. And then I have another question or two, Madam Chair.
Okay. And Representative Benson, are the questions any of them for the most recent testifier, Ms. Moriarty? Are there more for Representative Newton?
They're more for Representative Newton, unless he has someone who may answer.
May I add one more thing,
Madam Chair?
Sure, if you want to just quickly before we turn to that question, which is
in
important.
April of last year, I was awarded a awesome title of DSP of the Year through the Anchor program, and I received my award out in Washington, D.C., and I'm representing over 300,000 direct care professionals at this time through this year. And one of the things that I am doing right now is I am reading over 250 applications to find the lucky winner for this year's DSP award. And a lot of the things I want to say that we are basing our judgment on is the sacrifices that the people that work in these homes do, the sacrifice from their family. We also talk about how they help people get them out into the field for jobs, how they help get them out into the field for sports, how they help them. Some have helped them even give the initiative to be able to walk again. And I think that is something that people should understand, that it's really quite an honor to be a direct service professional.
Right. Well, thank you so very much for your testimony. And I think Representative Benson's question is more on the nature of why so little, if I could just recap it. Yeah. So Representative Newton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Benson. It makes me think at the first rally that we had this year that Representative Abler was a 5% button on each side, and he said, we really should be doing 10%. we have to do what we can do. It is strictly a financial issue, and we went for 5% last year. We had 1%, and so we feel that this year we should push for 1% again. The total bill will come to about $86 million, and 10% would be 172, I would believe.
And could I just add to that, or add to the question, Representative Newton? We keep talking about 1% last year, and obviously this isn't the Finance Committee. This will all be discussed in Finance. But we also stopped a cut that was set to go into effect, right? A 1.6% cut that would have taken effect, that was passed by the previous legislature, that would have taken effect, I believe, July 1st. So it's not really correct to say that we only did 1%, because in the budget that Representative Huntley was able to pass last year, he actually was able to allocate 2.67. But part of that, obviously, people didn't see because it was a cut that would have happened. Am I correct there?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, and
Mr. Larson.
Representative Benson. After the last legislative session, several of us got together for lunch and talked about this issue. And the nursing homes last year got a 5% increase, and we thought they very much deserved that. And we thought that that would be a good place to start. We were looking forward to the 2014 legislative session, knowing that it was a non-budget year, and we hadn't had a history of surpluses up to this point in time. So we thought 5% was a reasonable request under those circumstances. However, I'm sure that Representative Newton would accept any amendments to the bill.
And Representative Benson, I also heard in that answer, we'll be back. Yes, Representative Benson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I realize, this is not the Finance Committee, but I'm not serving on that one. And so, maybe we could discuss this on the floor of the House, but now that I have you here, I'd like to be able to pursue it just a step further, if I may.
Go ahead, Representative.
And that is, there's a discussion that there will be, and I believe there will be, regardless of what the majority leader in the Senate seems to be indicating, that there will be an increase in minimum wage, and one of the numbers that's being tossed around is $9.50. And I'm just wondering whether or not this 5% proposed increase will be sufficient then, considering the constraints on the nursing home community, to be able to pay the higher minimum wage of $9.50 or more. What percentage of nursing homes now pay in the range of $9, $9.50 Right. That'd be a question.
And Representative Benson, this isn't nursing homes, remember?
No. Nursing homes.
Yeah, this is not nursing homes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I'm
providers, excuse me.
Yeah. Representative Newton.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Benson. My understanding is that there's the average wage is $11 and a half an hour.
Okay.
I don't know if Mr. Larson knows how many, you know, what percentage currently make less than $9.50 an hour. But I am assuming that there are some.
Yeah.
And I have had a discussion with Representative Winkler, who's carrying the 9.5% bill, that any amount that we have on 5% would be over and above whatever we have on the $9.50 bill.
Okay.
Whether that happens or not, I don't know.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Okay. We have Representative Abler and then Huntley.
All right, you go.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to comment about two things. One is, the first thing was this 1.67. That was such a sure deal on this waiver. We all, you would have, wasn't quite a sure deal as the Viking Stadium bonds or the pull tab things. But that was a sure deal. Sometimes things don't always work out the way.
Just move it away.
Anyway, that was about $35 million to get $20,000 out of it. But this, the waiver that backed up this 1.67 was supposed to be like almost guaranteed. And nobody thought it would have to come to have to be paid. On the other thing, on the minimum wage question, I just wanted to comment about that. Some other groups have talked to me. If you do minimum wage, please don't take it out of this 5%. It will affect the upper people. Will get like a 1% or something. And there are some people making minimum wage or below the projected number. A lot of like overnight people, when they're sleeping, they pay $8 an hour to sleep, which is a pretty good job. But so that's just my comment about that. So I hope that who's ever negotiating that, if they're listening to this, that this is a separate thing. These people are in just dire straits. The 50 cents is not going to change their life. At least it shows we care about them.
Okay. Representative Huntley.
Just a comment on that question. And I actually talked to some people this morning. And we have the numbers for nursing homes. We don't have them for home community-based services, which is more complex, harder to get the numbers. But just the nursing home part of it, they have, if I remember right, about 16% of the nursing home employees are making below $9.50. And the net increase, if we brought them all up to $9.50 for nursing homes, and these are just estimates, but would be $4.6 million. And so if we went to home and community-based services, there's probably three times as many people working in that industry. And how many are below the $9.50, I don't know. But I would guess that it would be at least three times 4.6 million. And there is going to be an attempt to get that so that we don't just raise the people below the minimum wage up to $9.50 and then say everybody else sorry. That's, you know, that's roughly where the numbers are. How this is all going to work out with the budget forecast and everything, we don't know yet.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Huntley. And I have Representative Fritz on the list. I just want to remind members that we do have some more testifiers. We have other bills. We're going to be coming back this evening, 6:30, or call of the chair, because some of us have caucus. So, all right, Representative Franson's ready to go this evening, so we will definitely be coming back this evening, just so people in the room know that. And so Representative Fritz, quickly, and then we've got three more testifiers.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you very much. I just want to weigh in and just mention that in my neck of the woods, the folks that are doing this kind of work are making $7.36 an hour. I hear from them a lot, and they're holding three jobs. They're being waiters and waitresses, and they're working in these homes. They're doing outstanding work, and they're also trying to go to college. So this is huge. You cannot live. You can't pay gas to get to and from work on $7.36 an hour.
All right. Thank you, Representative Fritz. So next testifier, Daniel Pekonen. Thanks. Then we have Annette Greeley. Then we have Tracy Schendel. So if your name was called, please start coming down here. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
My name is Daniel Packinen, and I am with Delwood Gardens Assisted Living and Memory Care, a brand new assisted living facility that is actually opening tomorrow on 7th Street in St. Paul. I also work with Housing Alternatives Development Corporation, Elder Care of Minnesota. I am with Care Providers of Minnesota and the Long-Term Care Imperative. That sounds very impressive. I've never had the honor of sitting in front of a committee, so this is a new experience for me, and thank you for allowing me to be here today. I'm here to encourage us as a community to talk about the 5% Coalition. It is very important to myself, to the people that I employ, the people I work with, and more importantly, the individuals that I have come to know as friends, family, grandmothers, grandfathers, sisters and brothers, aunts and uncles, the people that have lived in the communities that I've had a privilege of working with. They have made the buildings their home and their communities. The people working there have helped make home for these residents. It is very important that we recognize the passion and the dreams that our employees bring to our residents, and vice versa, the people that live in these buildings, the emotions and dreams that they're able to share with the people that are working there, whether in assisted living, whether in a group home, utilizing one of the waiver programs. It's very important to recognize that. Talking about how we got to 5%. Well, in previous years, we've been dealing with roughly up to just short of 15% of cuts in the last numerous years. Yes, this year we get a 1% rate increase. Last year we didn't have a 1.67% rate cut. Thank you very much, but we need to do more if we want to talk about minimum wage. It's a wonderful conversation piece. People making $7 an hour taking care of individuals in a long-term care setting, assisted living. We need to realize that being in this industry is a passion. We do it because we care. If I have to make a decision for a $7 or a $9.50 an hour job, but I want to be a nurse, that's a very difficult decision to make. Maybe I want to become an LPN. Maybe I want to be an RN. By allowing this increase to happen, we can help encourage the individuals that spend their lives taking care of people that need help in the communities that they want to live in. Thank you once again. I'll be more than happy to answer any questions.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being here.
You.
First
thank
time,
you.
And you did a great job. Annette Greeley.
Yeah, good. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for letting me speak today on behalf of our seniors, our families, and the Elderly Waiver Program. My name is Nick Greeley, and I live in St. Michael, and I'm the Director of an Assisted Living for Guardian Angels by the Lake in Elk River. We have 90 apartments, 60 are assisted living, and 30 are memory care. We serve up to 18 seniors on the Elderly Waiver Program. Their ages range from the late 60s to the late 80s. They would not be able to live there in their home alone, nor would they have enough needs to be in a nursing home. I'm going to give you an example of one of our residents, and I'm going to call her resident Jay. She has memory issues and needs help with her medications, getting dressed, bathing, meals, and socialization. She's able to receive this in a home-like environment. The Elderly Waiver Program helps pay for her cares and allows her to have the independence of an apartment. Resident Jay will tell you that it will take a very big boot to get her to leave. Without Elderly Waiver, funding Resident Jay's options would be, of where she could live would be limited to a nursing home. By increasing funding, we're improving the housing options for our seniors like Resident Jay. Either through having home care in their own home or living in a home setting like assisted living, Elderly Waiver is a vital part of helping seniors receive assistance in their communities and helping them delay the need for living in a nursing home. Thank you for letting me speak today.
Thank you very much. Okay, we've got one more testifier, Tracy Schendel. sitting in the back? And there's a question. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And not a question. I just wanted to give a little bit of lead time as we're coming into our last testifier. Really appreciate the hearing on this today. I think all of us have been working on this for a while. I know we've had hearings in our districts and how much this means. And while this is always an issue that we go back and forth on in the past, and sometimes we can point fingers, I think this is a time where we're all really coming together when we've got some extra money, a way to pay for it. And so with that, I just want to send a strong sign to the disability community, to you, Representative Newton, the support that we have for this, and hopefully it can move through quickly and show our support. So I just wanted to ask for a roll call so I can have the chance to support this publicly as well as members. And I just don't want to catch anyone off if anyone's out of the room so that they can get back before we do that.
So Representative Mack requests a roll call, and then we are going to vote on this bill before we leave. So we want to do that quickly. So go ahead, please.
Do I have to pull this over here?
Yes.
Can you
hear
me?
Yep, pull it over. That's great.
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of House File 2408. My name is Tracy Schendel, and I work in a place called Lake Owosso Residence in Shoreview. It's a ICF DD facility that is owned and operated by Ramsey County, and I've been an employee there for 28 years, even though I look much younger. I serve as the president of the local 707, which is with AFSCME Council 5, and I'm also the head coach and team coordinator of the 22-member Special Olympic team, Go Flyers. Lake Owosso provides residential services to a sometimes challenging population of developmentally disabled adults. Many exhibit aggressive behaviors, they engage in property destruction on a daily basis, and many are injure themselves. It's been my experience that consistent, well-trained staffing are critical to each individual client's success, professionally and socially. All of our clients go out to work every day. They hold many community activities, and it's critical that we have staff that know them. Our facility is still reeling from the cuts of the last few years, and in 2012 they cut half the workforce and reduced the hours to most people down to half, which is hard to pay your bills on half a paycheck, and benefits, they're not even happening anymore. And while there are a few of us old-timers left like me, I'm in the twilight of my years at Lake Owosso, and I'll be retiring soon, and I'm very concerned about the high rate of turnover with the younger employees that are coming in. They're working at Lake Owosso, and they're also working at these other places making $7 an hour, and it would just behoove everybody to get the staff in there that are going to be there forever. We can see a lot of things. We just caught a med error the other day that almost killed somebody. We wouldn't have known that had we not known that person. So again, I support House File 2408. You, sounds like you all do too. And let's get Minnesota back on track to being the standard that we were in the 80s. I want other states to hold us, to hold them to us. I mean, we used to set the bar. And that kind of went away.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you
very much. Representative Johnson, we're going to vote. We need to vote. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I just want to thank you for talking about the turnover issue. And Harry Myron Center in Mankato shared with me that it cost them $2,000 to retrain each new employee. And it feels like water down the drain in a way when we can be investing in our current employees. And so thanks for bringing that up.
All right. Thank you. So, Representative Newton, I will renew my motion that House File 2408 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Liebling?
Yes.
Representative Moran?
Yes.
Representative Mack?
Yes.
Representative Abler?
Yes.
Representative Albright?
Yes.
Representative Allen?
Yes.
Representative Benson?
Yes.
Representative Franson?
Yes.
Representative Fritz?
Yes.
Representative Grunhagen?
Yes.
Representative Huntley?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Loeffler?
Yes.
Representative Lohmer?
Yes.
Representative Morgan?
Yes.
Representative Mullery?
Aye.
Representative Schoen?
Aye.
Representative Schumacher?
Aye.
Representative Ward?
Yes.
Representative Zerwas.
The word is yes.
There being 20 ayes and no nays, the bill is re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance.
Thank you very much.
Members, please, no clapping. We will, members, we can't really take up the next bill in the next 5 minutes, unfortunately, so we're going to have to ask everyone to come back. We will be in this room, 6:30 or call of the chair. The call of the chair part is important because we'll be in caucus, so please stay tuned to your email. We'll try to give you notice, and we will do our best to do that, and we are in recess. All right, good evening, everybody. I hope this mic is on. Okay. So even though members are still straggling in, we're just continuing. We're back from our recess, so we're going to start hearing the next bill so that hopefully we can members can get home and get some sleep tonight, not to mention all the nice folks who've come here to hear the bills. So House File 2526, Representative Norton. So I will move that House File 2526 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. So what that means, members and audience, is that the data practices issues that might be in this bill are going to be heard in another committee. So that means it's this the jurisdiction of this committee, which is a health committee, is the health impact of the bill. So I want to just say that at the outset so we can kind of stay on track. So Representative Norton, I understand you have an amendment.
Madam Chair, yes, I do have an amendment. It's the DE-1.
Okay, and then was there some
and I have a very small oral amendment.
Okay, we can incorporate that if you tell us what it is.
Yes. Madam Chair, on line 2.7, if we could strike the word may and use the language on the line above, have a right to, so that they are similar in style. That parents and legal guardians have a right to authorize in writing that the blood samples and test results, blah, 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 blah.
Okay, so on line 2.7, we're going to strike the word may and insert the words have a right to. So the line will read that parents or legal guardians have a right to authorize in writing. Correct? Does everybody have that? Okay. So we will incorporate that into the DE-1 amendment, and I will move the DE-1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. Motion prevails. Okay, so now the author has the bill in the order in which she would like to have it discussed. And so go ahead, Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you so very much for hearing this important bill in your committee. And I will appreciate the referral to civil law. I'm bringing this issue before this committee today because our current law is not working for newborns or for public health in Minnesota. Beside the impact on families, which you're going to hear about through some testifiers, the law is a huge barrier to new test development, our current law. Minnesota currently screens for more than 50 harmful or fatal rare disorders, so that early interventions can give these babies a healthy start. The Minnesota Department of Health has a full list of the screening panel, which is listed in the Newborn Screening Program Study, and I know committee members would have gotten a copy of that. I don't know if you've had time to read it, but there's a full list in there. And it's also on their website. The most common disorders tested for are congenital heart disease, hearing loss, sickle cell, cystic fibrosis, and PKU, just to name a few. The newborn screening card contains only the information about the mom and baby that will help staff interpret test results and contact the baby's primary care provider if more testing or a follow-up is needed. Storage of the spots provides for follow-up to positive tests or for other program needs as defined in law, and I'll go over those in a few moments. Further research requires parental, written, and informed consent, and I want to be very clear on that. This bill requires written consent by the parents to do research. Parents can currently opt out of the program
and that continues under this bill. Newborn screenings testing saves lives. There have been over 5,000 children's lives saved since 1965 when this program began. And it also saves heartache and health care costs as a benefit. With your support, we can return Minnesota to its former position as a national leader in this area. What I'd like to do, members, is quickly walk through the bill and let you know what the changes are, and then I have several testifiers, and I'd like you to hear their testimony, and then we'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have. So in the bill, as amended, so on the delete all, you will see that we've added legal guardians to the definition of parents. So some might consider that a technical change, but it also expands the reach to legal guardians. And it also increases the amount of information being given out beyond physicians to childbirth education programs, so parents can hear this multiple times. And that's, I think, a positive aspect of this new language. Down further on the page, we've removed some language subdivision because we're striking subdivision 6, so the reference to that has been removed on line 1.19. Line 1.20, we are explaining the benefits. It explains the benefits. Line 1.22 is the default position, and we're just trying to make that very clear that the default position is, and we're clarifying the opt-out position that parents have. So we've kind of maybe gone overboard a little bit in making it clear, but we thought if it was mentioned multiple times, and that second time is an addition based on some feedback we got. On the next page, you will see that a third newly added option has been put on line 2.5. And that's that parents or legal guardians have the right to elect to have the newborn screening performed, but not have blood samples and test results stored. So that's an additional level. We have many opportunities for parents to opt out, and also different off-ramps, if you will, for when they can decide that they don't want the storage to continue. And again, the line 2.7 was something we just amended, so the language was similar to the one before. But again, that parents have the right to authorize in writing that blood samples and test results may be used for public health studies or research. Line 2.10, we are adding we're clarifying the new choice, which is that the newborn screenings will be performed, but that the blood samples and test results will not be stored. In the section 2, this is the default language. The default is that storage will remain indefinitely, but this section also clarifies that new third option for folks. And subdivision 5, section 3, so line 2.32, I think this is a key factor that some people are misunderstanding, so I'm going to just try to be clear about this. This subdivision defines what the newborn screening program is, and the newborn screening program is different than research. Okay? So this defines in lines 1 through 6, and there's no change in that, but that's what the newborn screening program is. And then line 7 is the new addition, which simply says that the utilization of the blood samples and the test results can be used to develop new tests. That is not research. That is just using the blood spots to develop new tests. Okay, so that's the addition there. And that was in a different part of the bill before, and it's been moved into this section. And so the lines 3.12 and 3.13... this whole section is to describe what's part of the program and what is not part of the program, what is unrelated research. So as you drop down then to subdivision 7, that's where we get to the component that I think people have been confused about. That's additional research, and it requires, and let me be really clear about this, additional research requires signed consent by all parents. Okay? So no one can just have any research done without signed consent, and that, so we're trying to be very clear about that. It's with permission only, and that section takes out some of the old language. Again, on the next page, and in Section 5, Subdivision 8, it clarifies about the permission and describes when spots will be destroyed. And again, what this section says is if a parent opts out and says, I want the blood test done, I want all those tests done on my child, I want the blood spot taken, I don't want it stored, how that will happen. And the blood spot, the blood samples will be destroyed within 1 week, and that's at the time you sign it, or later on within a week of the request. But that the results will be destroyed at the earliest time allowed under the CLIA regulations. And that's a little bit of a change, and that came at a request, and we can talk about that with some of the experts. But there are federal regulations and laws, and just saying a date certain does not fall within the CLIA guidelines, and so we're just clarifying that. And I think the folks behind me, when they testify, can be able to answer a little more clearly about what those regulations are. So again, you'll see on line 4.19, that has been removed because that is part of the newborn screening program and not research. So that was put under the program section, and I clarified that earlier. We also added on subdivision 10, section 7, subdivision 10 on line 4.26, that a person at the age of 18, so we're adding this, a person at the age of 18 can request that their blood spots be destroyed. So again, further clarification. And then lastly, again, clarification about the CLIA standards so that the blood will be destroyed based on CLIA standards and not a date certain, because that wasn't, I think it varies and it's different from the various tests that they use. But again, we'll have the experts talk about that. And then, again, limited opt-in exceptions, saying parents and legal guardians of infants born prior to the effective date of this act may give the Department of Health written consent for storage and use because the law is changing and people may want to participate in a different way than they did last year because the blood spots will be stored. So that's an opt-in exception. So that's just a quick walk through the bill. I would like very much like for you to hear testimony. So we have a couple folks here who are going to come to the table, I think, and give more clarity to the situation, then we'll be happy to answer questions.
Okay, very good. So we're going to start with Dr. Sue Berry. Welcome
Berry
to the committee. And so, Dr. Berry, what we need you to do is just give us your name for the tape, because everything's being taped, and then go ahead and give us your testimony.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, my name is Susan Berry, and I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm a pediatrician and I'm a professor of pediatrics at the University of Minnesota, where I'm a specialist who treats children identified by newborn screening. I'm here to speak on behalf of the American chapter of the American Academy, the Minnesota chapter, perhaps the American one too, I don't know. The Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, which represents nearly 1,000 pediatricians and pediatric providers across the state. When I started as a pediatric specialist 33 years ago, it wasn't uncommon in my practice to see children with diseases now detected by newborn screening. Without screening, these children had disastrous beginnings for their lives where you never even got a chance to get started. I remember one baby in particular who died in her mother's arms with a condition that we would now discover from newborn screening, and that was an entirely preventable death. Today, nearly every newborn is screened for these and dozens of other disorders before they leave the hospital so that treatment can begin as soon as possible. As someone who's very familiar with the newborn screening process, I can tell you that the current law has already undermined the quality of this life-saving program, and this will worsen unless we restore it this session. I'm deeply, deeply concerned about the future of newborn screening in our state and our ability to save as many children as possible from needless suffering and death. Newborn screening is actually a process, not an event. It involves a few simple tests after babies are 24 hours old to detect heart defects, hearing loss, and more than 50 types of hidden yet treatable disorders. Early detection and treatment are absolutely critical. The process is really pretty straightforward. Hospitals send newborn screening data, including the blood samples, to the Minnesota Department of Health to complete the screening process and to do initial follow-up until a diagnosis can be established. And until recently, MDH kept newborn screening information on a long-term basis, to assure proper diagnosis, timely follow-up, and reanalysis if necessary, and to also learn whether the program was doing its job to save lives and improve outcomes. Under the new law that was passed in 2012, MDH must destroy this information far sooner and, in fact, has begun to do so, robbing families of a tremendous life-saving resource and stripping the system of accountability for its work. Most families probably aren't even aware of this change until perhaps it's too late. Under the current law, I shouldn't get carried away. Current law mandates most blood spots to be destroyed at 71 days when a baby's not even 3 months old and well before a diagnosis can be confirmed in many of our cases. Additionally, the blood spots of babies who test positive for a disorder are automatically destroyed by their second birthday, along with all the test results and the values of the test. This is not a medical record. It's gone, rendering them unavailable for further analysis. Minnesota has become one of a handful of states to destroy newborn screening results soon after birth, putting babies and families at risk. What's the harm in destroying data too soon, you could ask? Can't babies just be retested? And the simple answer is no in many cases. The newborn blood spot is a unique overview of his or her health at birth. It contains a variety of biological markers that are helpful in identifying and treating diseases even years from the time it's obtained. Once a newborn spot is destroyed, it can never be recovered or replaced. Long-term storage of newborn screening blood spots and test results are critical for accurate and timely diagnosis and treatment for specific diseases that may or may not be apparent right away. Under the current law, physicians have no way that's direct to access or reanalyze a child's newborn screening information after age 2. It's been destroyed. In fact, MDH is not even able to confirm that testing ever took place. The ability to access newborn screening results can be critical in emergency situations and is extremely helpful in cases of unexplained death. MDH serves as a point of contact since the test results are not always easily accessible in a child's medical record. In addition, long-term storage of newborn data and spots provide the basis for quality improvement and for new test development, which are necessary for saving even more lives. In fact, the state was forced to delay testing for severe combined immunodeficiency, sometimes called SCID, last year because materials weren't available to allow quality assurance for the test. The SCID disorders are deadly conditions, making it impossible to fight off infections, and it saddens me to note that some babies were almost certainly missed during this delay and died as a result of that disease. The arbitrary time frames under the current law are based on the premise of protecting patient privacy. In my view, this fear is misguided and comes at a high cost to children and families. While data privacy is something that everyone should be concerned about and is something that we in the medical profession take very seriously, it should not be based on unfounded fears or fail to take into account the many policies already in place that prevent unlawful access to individual data. We should not allow medical care to be compromised for the sake of suspicions of invasion of privacy. In Minnesota, newborn screening, as you've heard, has saved more than 5,000 children from lifetimes of chronic illness, disability, and death. So I would urge you to remove the arbitrary storage timeframes and expand the window of opportunity for health-related testing for the sake of the babies born now and in the future. There should not be an expiration date on critical health information that can save lives. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Berry. I appreciate that, and I'm looking to see if there are any questions from members. This would be a good time. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions. I'm not remembering why we made those changes in the past. And I'm wondering, are not all babies tested now? Home delivery, those kinds of things. What are the alternatives? Are they only the babies that are born in hospitals?
Dr. Berry?
Thank you. At this point, all babies, unless the parent specifically decides not to be tested, are offered testing and receive testing. This includes home births, includes midwife births, it includes in-hospital births, all babies, and over 99% of babies in Minnesota are tested for these diseases through a variety of mechanisms, all of which come to the state.
And Representative Ward, the short answer, I think, to your query about what happened is that there was a lawsuit, and the court, as a result of that lawsuit, interpreted our law in a way that some of us might not have agreed with, and that was the court's order.
Yes.
And Madam Chair, could I just clarify?
Yeah, Representative Norton.
Because some of the members at the table weren't here, nor was I, actually. Just before I was elected, there was an amendment, a change to our law that had been established, and we had been doing newborn screenings in a certain way since, I believe, 1965. And some changes were made by this body on the floor. And as I remember the story, Representative Liebling even stood and said, will this affect research at, you know, Mayo Clinic? I think you asked about our medical hospital. And we were told no. Only to find out very quickly that it was interpreted differently. And so I appreciate this question because I've received some emails saying, you can't do this because it breaks the law. The fact is the breaking of the law was a result of a change that had just been made a couple years ago, and we're trying to return to the way we had it before. Actually, not 100% because we've got a lot more off-ramps for parents and a lot more, you know, permissions and opportunities for parents to make a choice than we did before. But the lawsuit was a result of that amendment that was done a few years ago, kind of, as we always talk about, in the dead of night. And that's the lawsuit was as a result of the interpretation of that change, not the law as it used to be. And I think people don't, if you haven't been here, you may not know that.
Okay. Question, Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know, Representative Norton, could you give just a little more history? I just don't know. Do you know what the change was that the courts took issue with? Because I'm just trying to remember the timeline. Because I believe some of these changes that you're trying to reverse were from 2012 changes, correct? Or were they further back?
Further back.
Further back than that. Okay. Because was the court case... The court case was just prior to those changes made that you referred to. Is that correct?
No. Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
Representative Norton.
To go past you. The changes that were made in around 2006, I'm not exactly sure, 5, 6, 7, someplace in there. The recent court ruling was based on the law after those changes were made. So what we're saying is those changes have been harmful, and I think many of us were concerned almost immediately within a year about those changes, but then subsequent challenges to that new law are the things that the court has ruled on. So what we're trying to do is get kind of fix those changes that were made that have caused the court to have concern, and part of that has to do with the length of storage and how we store.
Right, but members, you know, we could, if we wanted to, we could get somebody who actually, you know, the complete history, but I think it's a little outside the scope, and, you know, maybe we can get a little summary of that later on if it's important. But anyway, we are where we are today, and I think the important thing is that the legislature sets these rules. The court just interprets what's there. So this is our program. It's up to us to set the parameters, and that's what we're attempting to do.
And Madam Chair, I appreciate that very much. And the chair asked for a visual. We didn't have time to get that, but I will get something to you. I've talked with Dr. Berry, and they can put a visual together that shows the program that we're outlining and the opportunities for parents to opt out and where they can do it and what it means along the way. So you have a visual, because there are many opportunities now and more opportunities this year with this bill than there have been in the past. But I think people are not understanding that. So we'll get a visual to you in the next couple days as soon as we can get something put together.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Norton. Other questions from members? Representative Albright.
And I'm not sure if the author can explain this, or maybe this might be something for MDH. So I'll just ask the question and see where it goes. But I'm actually looking at subdivision 3 and your DE amendment. And it's a function of the timing or the semantics in the words, in terms of the timing of when delivery or the offering of this information is made available to expectant parents or guardians, as the case may be. And I'm just wondering if this is spelled out and I'm not reading it. Is there a requirement during prenatal visits that this information is to be delivered to the expectant parents, or is it only provided at request by the expectant parents?
Representative Norton, you want to address that?
Yes, and again, this is, we're not changing that component of the law, and MDH could come and address that if they want, but it's my understanding that they're required to give the information, and we're adding an extra place for that information to be given, which would be at childbirth education programs.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the purpose of the question is really going to the point of the if you will, the physiological mental capacity of a person or parents at the time of delivery versus several weeks or months prior to, in contemplation of the ramifications for this very piece of legislation. So my question goes to the author in terms of, again, or to MDH, is it a function of this that we are requiring it, or just making it available once and then throughout the pregnancy, and oh, by the way, you're going to have to make a decision one way or the other in the delivery room or shortly thereafter, as opposed to when you've had a full night's sleep and you're not, you know, recovering from delivery and you've got an opportunity to think through this?
Madam Chair.
Representative Norton.
Thank you. Representative Albright, again, and if MDH would come down here and perhaps talk about what current practice is. We're not changing current practice, but we are adding the childbirth education programs for the very reason you're talking about. We're wanting to get it earlier so people have an opportunity to think and talk about it, and not just in the doctor's office, or certainly, as you're describing, not just at, you know, during a labor and delivery situation. But perhaps the department could clarify that for you.
Okay. Mr. Koppel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Koppel, Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Health. As I understand the question, you're asking when materials are made available and are they mandatory to be made available, Representative Albright?
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And just in the delivery room or during the pregnancy?
In the course of a pregnancy, at what point in time is it determined appropriate to initially or on a regular basis offer or provide that documentation to an expectant parent or parents, leading up to but also including at the time of delivery? When is it delivered, the paperwork, and is there a receipt authenticating that it has been received back, so that, in my way of thinking, it would be much better for the parents to have written off on this, one less thing to decide, way before they go into the delivery room.
Mr. Koppel?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, right now, you know, the Department of Health provides information to prenatal classes or to programs during pregnancy that could be delivered. We don't run those programs, nor, you know, we just send out materials about the importance of newborn screening. When the mother has a baby, then the test is going to be conducted. Then they are again approached by the nurse in the hospital saying, in a hospital, if it's in a hospital, it's just as an example, saying that we're going to do a newborn screening test. If you don't wish to have this test, we can provide you with the paperwork to opt out of that test. One of the problems of trying to get the sign-off early to say, and during pregnancy, to say at a prenatal class or at a physician's office, I want to have the newborn screening. I thought about it. Here's the materials. And when that mother goes to the hospital, that paperwork may or may not go to the hospital, may be at a different hospital. There could be so many circumstances that don't follow that earlier decision. It's so all of the description, you know, the decision to go ahead and have the newborn screening done is at that hospital. There has been a lot of discussion about other decisions around newborn screening, whether this, you know, in terms of contacting around whether it be research or other things at other times. But during, at the time of the delivery is when the mother is approached or the parents are approached to perform the newborn screening.
Representative Albright?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. It would stand to reason that in this age of electronic medical records and planning every phase out of a pregnancy and the delivery, that those records most assuredly should, unless there's an emergency where you got to deliver at a different hospital, are going to follow you right into the delivery suite. So I'm no expert on that, but I find it hard to believe that that electronic medical record would not include that consent form.
Representative Norton.
Yeah, and I'll just clarify. What you're talking about is current practice, and we're not changing that. In fact, we're enhancing it. So I understand you have concerns perhaps with current practice, and perhaps as we move ahead with medical records and people having chips in their pocket, we can talk further. But I think right now I'm taking the current practice and I'm enhancing it with another opportunity for parents to get the information early, so when they are asked at whatever hospital they're at, they're fully informed.
Okay. All right. Representative Ward.
Not to belabor this, I would... And maybe at another time would be more appropriate. But we've been talking about infant screening last year with a couple of a different procedure. But with the blood spots, I'd like to understand, and if somebody else wants to explain it to me later, that's okay. I'd like to really understand more about what you've triggered in me, Doctor, about why the infant blood spot is different than later. And why? What are we learning about that can be used later in life that makes it so important to have and retain that record?
Dr. Berry.
Thank you. I'm going to give you one example of something that I think fits the paradigm of what you hope will be done with this, which is that children who have cancer may have that cancer for reasons that we certainly do not know. And research that will prevent or ameliorate the occurrence of cancer, I think, is a high priority for researchers in the health of children. It turns out that there are likely to be informative markers, even at the time of birth, that may give doctors clues about the potential for cancer later in life, even childhood cancer. And those can be found in the context of the baby's environment, the baby's, in utero environment as opposed to our global environment. And that confluence of external and internal environment that may have an influence on something like cancer only happens right then. Later on, the child may be in a completely different environment, and the clues that ultimately will tell us about that childhood cancer are lost. Research has already been undertaken with parental permission to go back to blood spots and pull them back out and use that to try and deduce aspects of childhood cancer. Of course, at this point in our state, such research can't be done because the spots no longer exist. But other states maintain their spots, so this kind of research will continue. And again, you mentioned you wanted parental consent for those. Those kinds of research activities are always done with consent. In fact, eager agreement of the parents on behalf of their children.
Thank you. Representative Grunhagen, I think, was next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry I was late. I ran into two people who actually like me.
I couldn't get away from them. Okay. Doesn't happen very often.
I bit my tongue.
Remember. Yeah, right. Okay. Anyway, I apologize for being late. And I don't know what questions have been asked, so I'll just get right to the point.
Whenever you're asking, it's already been asked.
Okay. Do parents opt in, or do they have to opt out?
Okay, and Representative Brinkman,
we
did go through this.
Okay, then
carefully.
Maybe somebody else can clue me in on the
and
side.
You know, let's get through some other questions,
okay.
And then
yep.
I don't think it would be a bad thing for Representative Norton to kind of conclude by clarifying it yet again, because I think it's a key misunderstandings about this bill. But let's keep that for the end, because we have gone through that. Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, Representative Norton, if you can talk about Section 8, the repealer, and explain that. I don't really understand what we're repealing here.
Representative Norton.
Madam Chair, I believe it's Section 6. So the Section 6 is the component of the bill that tells you how long the blood spots could be stored, because that is no longer going to be part of the legislation. They can be destroyed, but they will now be stored indefinitely. So Section 6 is had the 71-day limit in it. So we're just taking that out.
Right. Representative Lohmer, let's ask staff to explain that for us.
Okay. Thank you.
Is this Ms. Olson? Was this yours? Yeah, could you tell us what's in the repealer?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that what Representative Norton just said was very accurate. What the bill does now is it changes the retention period to indefinitely. It repeals that time period for just the retention of the test results and the blood samples. It doesn't change what has to happen in order to retain that information in the first place. I don't know if I'm explaining that in the best way. I think Representative Norton actually did a better job of explaining that than I could do.
So, Representative Lohmer, as I understand it, what the bill is doing is replacing the old rules with a new set of rules. And so the old rules are being taken out so the new ones can be put in place. And I think you also kind of missed the walkthrough of what the new rules are. So let's go on, and we will be sure to have a new run-through. We have another testifier. We really want to get to her, and we will, at the end, if Representative Norton is willing, run through again very clearly what the rules would be under this bill. Okay? So let's move on then, if it's okay, to our next testifier. Welcome.
Thank you. Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Stacy Nugent. 4 years ago, on March 5th, 2010, I was the mother of a very happy, healthy, and spunky 2-year-old daughter, Paige. I was one of those moms that had really looked forward to being her mom and read every book under the sun. Unfortunately, 5 days later, on March 10th, 2010, I received the most horrific phone call any mother could ever receive at work. My husband screaming in the phone, letting me know that Paige was not moving, that Paige had died in her sleep. This completely unexpected tragedy was something that I could never have imagined, and even now, it's surreal to share my story. At that time, I was invincible. This type of stuff happens to other people, especially not people like me. Despite a very thorough examination conducted by a very knowledgeable medical examiner in Anoka County, Dr. Quinn Strobel, we still do not know why my daughter died. Her death has been classified as sudden unexplained death in childhood, also known as SUDC. SUDC is similar to SID, a diagnosis of exclusion when no other causes are known, and impacts children over the age of 1 year. SUDC is a relatively new diagnosis, and at the time of Paige's death, the SUDC program had only been in existence for 7 years. This means that there's really only 7 years of focused and structured research to attempt to unravel this mystery. I'm proud but still saddened to know that my daughter's samples from her autopsy have helped catapult SUDC research further, but overall there is still so much more to be learned. While I would like to know why my precious daughter died, the answers are especially critical because I am now blessed to be the mother of a subsequent daughter, who happens to be 2 years old, Presley. It is very difficult to get through the day worried that you may lose another child to an unknown cause. It's as if you wait around for the Grim Reaper to come around every corner. That is not a way to live or to parent your child, but this reality is my new life. I have pursued private genetic testing for Presley and have not found any reason for concern, but I have been told repeatedly that the answers could lie in Paige's samples. Last year it was suggested that I could use Paige's blood spot card that was kept with the Department of Health. I was thrilled and relieved to know that this option was available. I did not know that. When I investigated this, it was suggested that blood spot testing was still had some opportunities to get better, and I was encouraged to wait a little bit longer if I could, because the sample was still so small that we didn't want to risk wasting this last piece of my daughter, because that's all that we had left of Paige. So last month, I requested Paige's blood spot card in order to pursue testing after being told that the technology had improved. However, when I did that, I was notified that just the day before, the blood spot cards for both of my daughters had been destroyed. This news was absolutely devastating for me and my family, especially because we were never notified that they were going to be destroyed. This action is tragic for me, as I now do not have any other way to find out why Paige died, and is increasingly difficult for me to find ways to protect Presley. I wish I could go back to 4 years ago, just like other parents, when I did feel invincible, when I felt that these things happened to other parents. I am saddened and disappointed that over 1 million blood spot cards have been destroyed, because we really don't know how many more children we will lose to SUDC or other known conditions or unknown conditions. And I ask you, our representatives, to please restore the blood screening program, the newborn screening blood spot program, so that we can save the lives of other children. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And, you know, we're all very sorry about the loss, not only the loss of your daughter, but I think many of us, the inability to follow up. So thank you for your testimony. Are there questions, members? Okay, not seeing any. Thank you very much. Okay, I have another witness on here, Paula Bastian. She's not here. Okay.
She's a rep of the Senate, maybe?
Okay.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, so if there are no other questions for these witnesses, I have Twyla Braze on the list. Is she here? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, and good evening. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and we are the organization that brought nine families together who had been very disturbed about the health department keeping the data without any consent, without any authority in law, and looked for and in violation of the genetic privacy law, which the question wasn't exactly answered very well here, but the change that happened was in 2006, a state genetic privacy law was enacted that required informed written consent for the collection, storage, use, and sharing or dissemination of genetic information. And an administrative law judge found the department in violation of the genetic privacy law. And the parents later came together and sued because the department was unwilling to listen to the administrative law judge, unwilling to add consent, unwilling to do what was necessary to follow the law. And so in 2009, the department was sued, and in November of 2011, the Minnesota Supreme Court ruled that the department was indeed in violation of the genetic privacy law. And so that was what had transpired, and that's why the program was changed. Now, the interesting thing is just in some of the comments that have been made so far talking about current practice. Well, current practice with the Minnesota Supreme Court and with the 2012 amendments, current practice is that consent is required, not for the collection, because that's part of the newborn screening program, so it's not impacting the actual screening of children, but consent was required for the storage, use, and dissemination of this genetic information. It was sort of interesting because the Supreme Court ruled, the department said time and time again that the blood spot was not genetic information, said it in, you know, what they supplied to the court, but the court was like, no, it's absolutely genetic information. It's filled with DNA, and that's what it's being used for. And so current practice in current law is consent. And the genetic privacy law was consent. And so somebody asked about the process, you know, before the lawsuit and after. So the process before the lawsuit was that the department was just doing this of their own accord. No legislative authority whatsoever had been collecting the, keeping the database of results since 1986 and the newborn blood spots since July 1st of 1997. No legislative authority, just did it on their own. We discovered it in 2003 from a happenstance remark from the department.
Ms. Braze, we're here to consider legislation that will provide certain legislative authority. So could you please comment on the bill that's before us? I think thank you for giving some history, but now I think that just kind of, we're not going to relitigate here, so let's just move on from that, please.
Yes, Madam Chair, I don't care to relitigate. I just wanted to make sure that the facts were actually out on the table, considering what I had heard previously. So so to be clear, nobody signs off in this piece of legislation. There was a question about opt-in versus opt-out. Nobody signs off, and no decision is made unless you know that there's a decision to be made. Then you can ask for the piece of paper. And I think when you ask about what the health impact is of this bill, it's important to know what some of the newborn screening researchers have said. And so one woman from the University of Michigan, a professor who did a forum on the use of residual newborn blood spots, said, in my experience, in being in these forums and these focus groups, most parents are completely stunned when they find out that their child's blood is being held by the state. They have no recollection, and they think it's unlawful. And that what is really the decay of the public trust, in my assessment, is that there hasn't been a real public awareness campaign around it. So that it seems that when you get the information that it's been hidden, and hidden for a reason, that you don't want me to know, that you want to keep it under the radar for what purpose? It looks fishy from the very get-go. The reoccurring questions actually are relatively, I'll call it, simple, and they come from everywhere, across ethnic groups. How did they get my blood? What have they been doing with it? You know, why didn't they tell me? What else haven't they told me? Why should I trust them now? How are you going to protect it? And then who's paying for this? So this is a researcher who has done forums with parents who've thought that this whole process of keeping it without their consent should be illegal. And so, when we're talking about what the impact is, we're talking about trust. And the fact of the matter is the parents, when they go into the hospital, they have no clue. A lot of them actually can't remember newborn screening being done. Some of the researchers say that parents say they were just in a fog. And then they have no idea that it's really the hand of the government reaching in through the hospital, because they think that the hospital lab is doing this. So what we're really talking about is the hospital becoming an untrustworthy place as parents discover what this is. And as a matter of fact, some person from the health department in Hawaii at a forum said that, you know, one of her concerns was that people were choosing not to have the newborn screening at all because they were so afraid what the government was going to do with it. And so what we're doing with this bill is moving backwards. moving away from consent and to dissent for those who happen to be aware of what's going on, when researchers all over the country say parents are clearly not aware, and when they do find out, they think it should be illegal. So the only thing I'm going to add to that that you probably don't know, when we think about the government being able to keep this, and when we think about what Dr. Berry said when she talked about the biomarkers that tell from at birth whether or not you might get cancer, we really need to think and talk about containing costs. Well, what could that mean? What could that mean? Could that mean that you start to check children from even in utero or before or after or when they're married, right? So what could that mean? And so just so that you know, test development and research. So there's been talk about what's research here. You can Google it all you want. Look for the words research and test development. And you will find articles that talk about how they get these grants for research, and it's all about test development. So this bill says that test development, looking into the genes and the genetics of these children, into their DNA, is not research. This is clearly research. And the fact that it is put into this bill as though it wasn't research doesn't make it not research. This is research being done without consent on the genetics. It's genetic research without parent consent. And you just need to know that before you take a vote. And finally, the U.S. government has paid $25 million to four entities around this country to develop full genomic sequencing for newborns. In other words, to detail the child's genome at birth, every little piece of it, which will then become part of a government record in a database that is kept interminably, indefinitely. And so you need to consider really carefully what you're doing when you're taking away parent consent and repealing parent consent.
All right, we have questions for the author, so thank you, Ms. Braes. Representative Mack.
And Madam Chair, are we done with testifiers? Because it can wait till the end.
Yes, we are done with testifiers.
Okay.
Oh, and is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against the bill? Okay, there's a gentleman here who wants to testify. Welcome to the committee, and please give us your name.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Don Lee. I'm from Eagan, Minnesota. I think that's protocol, right?
Yes, go ahead,
okay,
Mr.
Excellent.
Lee.
I'm here because I've heard of this bill. I was following the genetic testing and the newborn screening and the brouhaha around it and the court case and so forth. And to me, the question is very, very simple. It is about consent. And it's something that is a habit of government these days. If it's a good idea, it has to be compelled. Sounds like newborn screening is a really great idea. Sounds like a lot of kids will benefit from it. Sounds like a lot of research will come from it. Sounds like a really strong case can be made. So why not get consent? There are lots of people who don't like their DNA stored. And they may not be aware of what the state is doing. And as they've pointed out, you're in a fog when you're giving birth. You've got other things to worry about. And somebody shoves a form in your face, you know, you're maybe, you know, throw it on the floor, maybe slap the guy that gives it to you. I don't know what's going to happen. But it's not a thoughtful decision. And for the state to reach in and say, we're not going to give you that decision, we're just going to do what we wish, unless you go out of your way to make sure we don't, seems just a hair tyrannical to me. That does not seem like a good idea. And that's what the genetic privacy law did prior to 2006. It said, unless you had consent, informed consent, like everything else medical, you don't do it. It comes down to a question of who owns my DNA, and by default, that should be me, and also for my children. None of this conversation, I hear a lot of things from the testifiers here about how this change is absolutely essential because otherwise screening is not going to be done. I'm not quite clear on that, but it sounds to me like the consent is not necessary for the screening. That happens by default anyway, It's the long-term storage, the forever storage, of this most intimate information about a human being, your DNA. That's not a question. And this is just flipping the consent so that you have to do something extra to not do that rather than to give consent to have that storage done. So some of this is based on things that are simply not true. The screening itself doesn't seem to me in question, and that's what's being used to justify this change.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Lee. I'm going to let the author now discuss again for the members who weren't here.
Thank you.
To go through the bill again, and Representative Mack has a question, but maybe we should let her walk through the bill again and explain, because I think some of there's misinformation about what is actually in the bill. So, Representative Norton, why don't you go through it again and explain what the bill is doing with regard to consent.
Okay, and I may need to call a friend if I don't hit all the points.
Okay.
But, Madam Chair and members, currently parents are informed during their pregnancy, and we're adding during their Lamaze classes or their childbirth education classes, they're being informed about the test and what it means, what it is. Currently, and again, we're not changing current practice, and I want to clarify that again. We're not changing current practice. Currently, parents are given that information, and they can opt out of having the blood spot done. Currently, they can choose to go to a private vendor for their blood spot. Currently, they can go to the vendor and have the blood spot stored privately, or they can go through the state's program. Again, they can just stay in, or they can opt out. It's their choice. So we're adding that they can opt into the test but opt out of the storage. That's a new component to the bill. So we're not changing current practice. We're adding another dimension to it. Any research beyond the newborn screening program has to have written parental consent to do any research. That isn't changing. That's what's in current law now, and we have affirmed it in this legislation. So again, it's keeping the current practice, but adding, if you will, more off-ramps for parents and an 18-year-old when they become of age to say, I don't want my data, my blood spot stored any longer. So we've added components.
Okay, and then I think, Representative Norton, I think the piece about what about for the program itself, that's the piece that I think you need to explain how that's been defined now and what does a parent, what kind of consent or opt-in, opt-out is it for that in the bill?
Again, the move has been, well, let me get out the bill and I can show you online a page, just a moment. I can find the bill. I have one marked up copy that would be easier to reference if I can find it. So we are adding to the current program that parents choose to opt out of. Again, currently that's what they do. We have added to it the utilization of blood samples and test results for studies related to newborn screening, including studies used to develop new tests. That's the only new thing we've added. That is determined as part of the newborn screening program. So when parents choose to allow the blood spot to be taken and kept for storage, it can be used for those seven purposes listed, six of which they've always been able to do, and the seventh we added for clarification, that utilization of blood samples and test results for studies related to newborn screening. So if we want to add a new disease, these related to newborn screening. So if we want to add a new disease to that screening, that they can use the samples, the old samples, to see if it's viable to add a new test to that screening set that is listed in the program. It's 50-some tests. That's the only thing it can be done without written parental consent. It's part of the newborn screening program.
And Representative Norton, so as I'm understanding it, a parent could say, test my child for right now, do the newborn screening test, but don't keep my blood spots.
Absolutely.
And then what happens?
They will be provided a form. The blood spot will be kept for, I want to say, is it 7 days? Destroyed within a week, so 7 days a week, sort of the same. And then the CLIA standard is the change that's been put in because the results of that test sometimes take longer, and to just put an arbitrary date in there may not be appropriate. So the CLIA standard has now been used. So it will be, depending on the test, whatever the CLIA standard is for that test to get the results, then it's destroyed.
Okay. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that was a helpful walkthrough. So as someone who has had a baby on this side of the past year, all of this is very fresh, and I did ask a lot of questions about this as I was going through the process. And I guess a couple thoughts, because I agree with the testifier that said, you know, the screening, testimony is compelling about the merits of screening, why it's in the best interest of families and children and future research. I understand that. I do take issue and have concerns with the piece of that we keep circling around, opt-in, opt-out. And I think you just did a very good example or clarification of what it involves here. But I guess I just have a issue with when the onus is on the individual to tell the government to stay out of their life versus the onus being on government to prove a case for why they should be let in. And so I guess I don't understand the fear or the, I won't say fear, no one said that, but the resistance to have this be an opt-in. My concern is it's been made clear, and it's said, and I remember in 2012 or what year the Department of Health said they will make a robust effort to amp up education to young parents, expecting parents, so they understand, they have a good handle, the case is made for why this needs to be done. And in some of my little free time, I've made some calls to about 10 different providers, prenatal providers, in the last 24 hours, and got through to about 7 of them. And not is when I asked, do you have materials in your office? And these were large providers, multiple clinics. And I said, do you have information in your clinic that you provide to expectant moms? And not a single one really even about the newborn screening program. And none of them really knew what I was talking about. So I thought, well, could I talk to a nurse? Maybe the receptionist doesn't know what I'm even referring to. And I got calls back from nurses, and none of them had any information in their clinic. They said, well, I think we could go to a website if we wanted as a nurse to quick have to reference that if we get asked about it. But again, the onus is on a young mom, a young woman who doesn't know anything about this. And so I'm disappointed in what appears to be a lack of follow-through from the department that said, we'll do a robust move to follow what's in statute. And I'm not a proponent of mandating new things on providers per se, but it doesn't even seem like there's been an effort to clue in providers that during pregnancy would be the best time so that parents know. And I have a lot of friends who are in the stage of having kids. And, you know, if this ever comes up or if, you know, they've asked me about it, and none of them really know that this even happens. It is a blur when you're in the hospital, and it is hard to think straight. And, you know, have the clarity of mind to say, hey, can I look over that paperwork and just understand the newborn screening? It's really not readily available even at that point unless you've got the wherewithal and enough education on the issue to ask for it. And so throughout the bill, I see, you know, the legal guardians elect not to have, the word elect not, but it just says the onus is on these parents, very, very often unknowing. They don't know that any of this even exists. And so I guess I'm just wondering why the move away or why the unwillingness to just inform parents and let them sign a piece of paper. That's my question
to you. And Representative Norton, you could certainly try to answer that. I think Dr. Berry might be a good person to answer why opt out and opt in are not equivalent if she's
join me if, she'd like.
If she'd like to do that. But go ahead.
And Madam Chair, there's a number of things in that speech that you gave that I want to touch on. First, I'm the mother of four. I actually and someone talked about being in a fog, and sometimes you are and sometimes you aren't. I very specifically remember this discussion about the blood spot. I very specifically remember having that. I think I was in Missouri at the time, about the blood spot and what they were going to do with it. And, you know, it was fine. I didn't sign anything, but, you know, they were very clear about what I was going to do. So my personal experience in the delivery rooms was perhaps different than the gentleman suggested. And I just want to be clear again, we're not changing the current need to opt out or the written consent. It's current law that you guys kind of helped us negotiate several years ago. So I'm not changing any of that in this bill. It's remaining as it currently is. So I just want to be clear about that. And I share your concern if child, and so I'm pleased we're adding the child care provider, the educational component, thank you, with the child educators. I think that's a positive. And I share your concern if physicians aren't sharing this. I know they're required to, in the delivery room, talk about these options, but I would like it done earlier, too, and I'm happy to deal with that. It's not what we're dealing with today, necessarily, but I share your concern, and I certainly think that's something we can look at. And then I'll answer what I know and then let the doctor give probably the better answer. But one of the things when you do research is you want a universe of tests that reflect the communities. And when you start asking for an opt-in, you get an adverse selection, perhaps, of people that sign. There are different cultures, a variety of reasons, distrust, and the more you talk about it, perhaps you may even raise fear. But then you don't have a universe of research samples that are the same as the universe of people that live in the state of Minnesota. And I know that's very important to researchers to have a proper sample. And I think there's some concern that the sample would be skewed, which is why I think the wisdom of this body, Republicans and Democrats alike, over the last couple of years, have kind of come to the place where we've said we will have informed consent for research, but let's get this newborn screening, let's save these babies, and let's do it the way that we'll have the most amount of participants.
Dr. Berry, do you want to?
You probably have a more clear answer.
I think you summarized that pretty well, which is that particularly for the component where new tests are developed, it really needs to be that the test reflects the values, not in the values in terms of the cultural values, but the physiologic blood values of the population you're working with. And we have a unique population in Minnesota. If we develop tests that are based on Michigan baby blood spots or California baby blood spots, which we could, it won't reflect and won't, for that reason, be correct and protective of the babies we have born here. So particularly with regard to new test development, which particularly the tests that are likely to come on board now are not experimental or unusual in any way, but they are, because of how we do newborn screening, done state by state. And the cutoffs and the decision making for any normal value is really based on what's going on in that state. So if you don't have an appropriate collection of spots, you're going to really have problems.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I appreciate the importance of the broad spectrum for good research. But I guess what it sounds like we're saying is that the hesitation to have people sign off or opt in, and I understand we're not changing, but kind of why we wouldn't want to go that direction. It sounds like by informing people, we would be scaring people. And I guess I don't think that's the message we want to send. I think, like I said, I think the merits of the screening kind of stand on its own. And parents want that for their kids. And so I don't think, you know, the department or, you know, government as a whole is doing itself any favors. I think communicating with people, I think giving them the benefit of the doubt that they can digest the information will dismantle fears, always kind of opens up transparency and builds trust versus things not being communicated only to find out later erodes trust. So I guess we could agree to disagree on that point. But I feel like what's being said is by informing people, we're going to scare people. And so we're going to scare people from not wanting to get this done. They'll opt. They won't want to do it. They won't sign the paper, and we'll get skewed results.
And Madam Chair, I'd like to perhaps just say maybe scare wasn't the proper word. But I believe some personally that some of the tactics that have been used and the language that's been used around this subject, as we've discussed it, has been a scare tactic to the community. I personally feel that. So scaring can go both ways. If you scare people about government, that also can have a detrimental effect. So it's not just scaring people about the test, but I think just the messaging on this issue sometimes is skewed, and I would worry that that kind of skewed messaging might affect the outcome.
And just one final thought.
Yeah, and then I have two other members on the list, Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly, and I agree. I think semantics and fear tactics can be used on both sides. I definitely agree with you. I guess I just side on the over-informing and giving people as much information, make an educated decision, and let them make that choice, and have the onus on government to prove the case would just be the stance I would take on that. But thank you.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've been through this bill a few times, I remember, and I feel like Tavia on Fiddle on the Roof. I agree with everybody. The people of concerns, the people bringing the bill forward, and I think at the end we have to find a product that we can actually make work. And I'll have a few comments too, but I think we need to work, if we can keep it at 18 years, I think that helps instead of like till year 25 for the retention. I think that's something that we need to work on. I think you need to define research better compared to new tests. I think that's a reasonable point compared to life markers and all that. And, you know, and some of these things seem preposterous, but when Jurassic Park came out, you could never get a mosquito, you know, or what make one of these dinosaurs out of the mosquito, and maybe you hardly can, but it's we've come to that point, and the world's going to go far beyond this in 100 years from now. And so we don't know what technology can do and where we're going to get to. And so I think there's some reasonable points offered by the people that have concerns about this. We have fought the opt-in, opt-out fight for my entire career here. Mm-hmm. And I think at some point it's going to stay at the opt-out version, just realistically, just in terms of practical counting votes and the lay of the land and all that. So how do you make it as good an opt-out as possible? Governor Plenty used the term robust opt-out, which I think you're getting more robust. But I think that, to Representative Mack's point, the information to the patients is weak. Not as weak as it was when he fought this discussion 6-8 years ago, and it was a mosquito print on the bottom of some brochure on page 7. But I still think that people do want to know what they are keeping in keeping with the Jurassic Park phenomenon, which may occur. I want to support this bill eventually, probably not today, but I want to be for what you're trying to do. And to Ms. Nugent, I'm so sorry. And I lost a son too, so I'm so sorry, daughter you had. But I will predict that some of the people with the greatest concerns about this bill, when their granddaughter or grandson passes away because it's something they could have prevented, they would have wished that they would have had this program in place. There are so many testimonials about people who did not die because of the work this does. This is a program that we discussed the tanning thing with all respect. And that may help some people. I don't know. We don't quite agree on that. But on this thing, people will live longer when we can get this squared away to have the best protections to the families and the best protection about research. And, you know, the next discussion coming up is end of life and who's going to be costing more. And I think we need to remember that as we discuss how long we're keeping this and what they can do with it and various opt-ins or outs for what can be done to that data. And so I think that's just prudent now, and I think you've got there's a strong author of a marvelous presentation, well-intended people on both sides of this table here that want to find a way to make this program work so it's as safe as it can be and get the good out of it without the intrusion that people really fear. And 20 years ago, there would not have been a fear about the intrusion, but today, with who's listening on my phone and everything else. Thank you, Representative Norton, for your work, and I'll work with you yet if you would like. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Hey, thank you, Representative Abler. Representative Benson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, listening to this discussion and Representative Mack with your investigation, I'm just curious as whether or not you actually talked to pediatricians or whether you talked to nurses or others. You know, my wife is in healthcare, and lots of times people who work in healthcare are not specifically involved in something like this. And it just strikes me that, unless I misheard, something around 99% of children are tested. And since pediatricians, whatever time it is, are visiting with the parents about this testing, it seems logical to me then that 99% plus of parents are thinking it's a good idea to have this test. So there's a small percentage of people who apparently don't, for whatever reason. In my opinion, they're making a mistake, but in a free society, you can make mistakes as well as making correct answers, I guess. So I'm just wondering, in your regard, whether any of these persons you visited with were actually pediatricians whose job it is, in a delivery room or whenever, to present this this testing as an option.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the question. I did not talk to any pediatricians. I actually did from some of the nurses that I spoke to on the phone. They would refer me to, you know, contact the pediatrician. So they pointed me that direction, to their credit. I guess the only point that I would make is that in the statute, it clearly says information should be made available to prenatal providers. And so I was more, you know, looking on the side of, a lot of times, I know for me, I didn't necessarily have a pediatrician chosen, at least for my first child, until in the hospital, and then I saw one there, and then they said, well, why don't you come keep seeing us, or whatever the case might be. But the information also about the blood sampling never came from a pediatrician. It was just mentioned in the nurse when they took the baby away for hearing. The pediatrician never spoke, you know. So that, my only issue was in calling folks that do, you know, OBGYN and prenatal care, is that it specifically says in statute that piece. I was just looking for that information.
Representative Benson.
Well, just a quick follow-up. You know, I don't remember specifically, and I don't know if I was even here when that legislation was rewritten, so I don't remember. But a lot of times when this legislation is written, people don't think about that much as to whether pediatricians should be required to present it. I suspect there might have been people who would have objected to having a directive from the state to require a pediatrician to present this. So I bet there was probably a compromise somewhere along the line, and they said, well, what we'll do is we'll send the information off to the pediatricians, and since they're the professional health givers here, we'll let them make the decision. That gets us off the political hook here of having big government telling private providers what they ought to be doing. I don't know, but I suspect that could be, being around here the last 8 years, it makes sense to me that that could be how it worked.
Okay, thank you, Representative Zerwas. Representative Zerwas is next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I think I would agree with a lot of what Representative Abler said. I think this this bill, for me, my main concern for what's occurring now, and I think what should concern, I think, most of Minnesota, is the idea of what Minnesota's always been, as far as a healthcare pioneer and a leader in healthcare. And when we look at the potential and the lives impacted and saved and prolonged through just the amazing results of catching birth defects early and using newborn screening, and we started with one. We screened for one test, and now we screen upon birth for 56. And now we have in law, do not try to develop any more tests. That's not the Minnesota I know when it comes to healthcare. That says, we're done innovating. We're done trying to save more lives. That's wrong. That's wrong on many levels. There are concerns around opt-in, opt-out. There are concerns around, you know, what this looks like years down the road. I understand all of that. But the Minnesota healthcare system that saved my life and thousands of others didn't do that by saying, we're done innovating. We're done trying new things. I think there's plenty of work to do to make people more comfortable with this bill. I look forward to partnering with Representative Norton on it. I'm voting yes today in hopes that we can find more common ground as this moves through the committee process. But we have to all agree that the Minnesota healthcare system at no point says we're done trying to investigate, we're done trying to innovate, we're done trying to improve healthcare in Minnesota. Lives are depending on us to work on it. They're depending on us.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Representative Franson. And then members, and then we're going to vote on this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My big concern is that if it's opt out, that there is no reason to inform. And if there's no reason to inform, then there is no consent, right?
Madam Speaker, the current law in the state of Minnesota is that we inform parents and that they will go ahead with the blood spot and the current law unless they choose to opt out. But they are given that information and they make the choice.
So even
Representative Franson.
Thank you. So even under your bill, would they, there would still be, the consent would still be there, you'd still be informing?
The information doesn't change, it okay. remains as it is. In fact, it's expanded. Then parents can choose to opt out. But if any research is done beyond newborn screening program, they must have a written consent. And we're keeping that in the bill.
Okay.
So Representative Norton, just to be very clear, when the baby is born and the pediatrician or whoever is going to take the blood, is the parent told that they have the right to opt out?
They are yes. They are given the information and asked whether they want to participate or if they want to opt out. If they say they want to opt out, they are to be provided the paper to do so. And they can opt out of just the blood spot. They can take the blood spot and opt out of the storage and the blood spot program, or they can stay in for the whole.
Okay.
Way.
All right, members, I think we're fully informed and ready to vote on this. And so I will renew the motion to that House File 2526 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative
Norton. Thank you very much
Thank
for
you
your time and attention to this really important bill.
House File 2449, Representative Abler.
Come sit there. They'll both sit over there. You can sit here by the microphone. So. Actually, that's funny. So then you come over here.
It's okay. I was laughing.
You could.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Representative Abler
Thank
is
you, Madam
going
Chair, I
to move that House File 2449 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance.
That's right. I should have missed the consent calendar, Madam Chair. So
we don't have one.
So, did you abolish that? That was such a great thing. Get it done quick. Anyway, so I wish we had more time to go over the merits of the organization we'll be talking about. Eagles Healing Nest in Sauk Center has rescued, and this is Melanie Butler. She's going to talk just briefly about it. I know it's late and it's been a long day. So we talked about keeping young people alive and Hardy and Hale. Now we're talking about keeping our veterans and alive and hearty and hale, Madam Chair. They are absolutely at risk, having come back from various deployments. And so this place that Melanie and some of her friends have put together and her heroes here is in Sauk Center. They took over an old DHS facility, and they house 42 people. And frankly, take them off the streets from the gaps of the VA system, which is a whole different hearing. And a lot of them are eligible for GRH, group residential housing. And just because of challenges with the county, they don't get qualified for that. And so Melanie has to fundraise $25,000 a month to feed and house and provide modest programming for these outstanding veterans of ours. And so the bill simply says that Eagles Healing Nest, there's one other group in Stearns County that may actually evolve, but they could directly contract with the state should the state desire to contract directly with them for these functions. And the point of that is these men come from all over the state and maybe even from other states, but they are ours, a responsibility and our proud duty to look after. And so that's the bill. And so, Madam Chair, let me move the bill, actually move an amendment. It just makes it effective after the date of enactment. So I can move the A1 amendment.
Okay, so Representative Abler moves the A1 amendment. Does everybody have that? And that just changes the effective date. And all those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails.
So, Madam Chair, we have four witnesses. I'm only going to use one tonight, just in interest of time. But Ms. Butler would love to tell you what she can in the time she has about her this outstanding place. And I urge members, if they're passing by a Sauk Center, to stop in and share a meal with these men and Melanie, and you will be inspired. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Thanks for hanging around.
Thanks, Madam Chair, for having us.
So just give us your name for the tape, and then go ahead.
Melanie Butler. I am a military wife of 22 years. I am a military mom of three. We have four deployments in our family in less than a five-year time span. My family proudly served the Minnesota National Guard. Unfortunately, my country failed my family. So when my son was in crisis, when he came home from deployment and he was suicidal, I called what we were told to call, and they said, "You can't bring him here." Well, our local hospitals fear veterans as well. So I woke someone up in the middle of the night, a general, and he made room. Unfortunately, my son's battle buddies were committing suicide. I saved my son's life that night. His battle buddies saved his life. It took me back to a time around a campfire that a platoon of Vietnam veterans, I made a promise to them that I would always care for veterans. So when that system failed, the general told me, when I cursed him out, "Come to me with a solution, not a problem." So I enrolled in school. It's a long time to get a degree. I'm not there yet. I'm about a semester and a half out. But Minnesota has the highest rate of suicide. There's a gap in a system when our veterans are waiting for their funding, or they're told that you don't live in this county or that county. We ask our veterans and our military families to make a sacrifice. They build communities all over the world. They take care of each other on the battlefield, and back here we take care of them through family readiness and Beyond the Yellow Ribbon. Beyond the Yellow Ribbon started here. I sat around those big round tables when we were making the decisions of what a Beyond the Yellow Ribbon community is. Minnesota has a Beyond the Yellow Ribbon state. So we decided that we would create our own place to heal with honor. So an American Legion and Clarissa came to my house and said, "We heard you're the mom on the mission. We're Vietnam vets. We want to make sure the next generation doesn't." Great, wonderful. I said, "I'm a long ways from being able to open an 8-to-10 bed facility." Although I had a vision, I started it the first week, created the name. The need was too great. Minnesota has the highest rate of suicide. My home was becoming overrun by my children's battle buddies, by my husband's friends. But if you put them all together, they could heal. So we rallied together volunteers, and we renovated two buildings. We don't receive any funding. Our Legion riders, our military families, our Blue Star mothers from the top down, we receive donations clear from Okinawa, $25,000 a month. We provide the transportation to their appointments to the VA. to see their families. The programmers provide funding and their services for free. We're not asking for a handout. We're asking that the state allow us and to have a whole state. Our veterans serve all of America. Our veterans in Minnesota are our heroes. And we don't deal real well with red tape, and I don't do real well with being told no. That's why we're housing 42. We have been at maximum capacity for 17 months. You're looking for the most cost-effective way to heal our veterans. Allow us to do it on our terms. There isn't anyone running out to get them. In that 40 below weather, I receive calls from the Department of Veterans Affairs clinics. The A didn't know one veteran's name. They called to house one with me. And she says, I have four, and didn't know their name. I can tell you every veteran's name that comes through our door. Everyone that comes and uses a service. We're not a handshake. We're not a last four of their social. We're home. And when they come, that's how they feel. So we're not asking for a handout. We'll do it. We have union contractors ready to come in and renovate the buildings. But I have Northern Minnesota counties calling with veterans, blessed that the facility's there, offering funding. And I say I can't have it because Stearns County told me no, based on legislature from a few years ago. And I said, great, what do I need to do? And he says, get them to change legislature. Good luck with that. Here I am 17 months later. Don't make a military mom mad. But please join us in helping them. They're creating it. They're being peer-to-peer certified. They're doing it. You want cost-effective? We don't need $54 billion. We need a helping hand up with funds that they're eligible for. They're in a backlog getting their claims, backlog getting services. They have the tools. We teach them. They're warriors, and so are their families. Help us build our nest.
Well, Ms. Butler, thank you very much. We're honored by your presence here, and you are quite a woman, and we're really honored to hear about this, and thank you so much for the service, your service, and all of your service, because you got some veterans here with you today, and thank you for your service to them. Could you, are there questions from members? Okay, I just wanted to ask, I hope it's not going to open up a big can of worms here, but I just kind of wondered why Stearns County is giving you so much grief. Is there a
Madam
simple
Chair.
Answer?
If I could give you an answer to that, I would be honored to do that. I don't know why I ended up in Stearns County, because I actually raised my family in Deer Creek, Minnesota. And we moved after my husband's second deployment to outside of Staples to be closer to his job. Ultimately, I was going to get my degree and go to the VA and wear my boots that I wore here today. But that's not. Dr. Sheridan from Volunteers of America has been working with some of our veterans. Dr. Owens is helping us create the evidence-based program. But ultimately, it was another veteran that served with our husbands and for that said, there was something trying to be started in Sauk Center. Problem was, it was filled with people that wanted to line their pockets. And that's not what the nest is about. And so we did this all on volunteers, everybody. So we went there, and all the way there, I was praying for a sign, and the eagles were flying over my car, and they flew in over. And the first year, the first weekend, we started to renovate. A pair of Osprey eagles built a nest on a telephone pole. And it was a sign that that's where I needed to be, because 4 years ago, the name Eagle's Nest was created on my laptop to give the veterans a place to heal with honor. Last year, well, the city, bless their hearts, pushed our nest over off the telephone pole. DNR and the community raised an uproar. And DNR said, you will go put their nest back. That is their symbol. Last year, a pair of bald eagles had their nest. So we just call it building it one branch at a time. We don't know why we ended up there. We just say it's a wing and a prayer. But it's home to us. Our community across the state embrace us. Our donations come as far away as Okinawa. They come from all over the state. Matter of fact, when we leave here, I have to go to two Blue Star Mothers organizations, and they do that. You're looking for cost-effective. You're looking for ways to truly heal our veterans. This is what they need. And they say that from the National Director of Homelessness, from the military of the Purple Heart, Jim Logsdon, who raised our POW flag. This is the model the veterans are looking for. Not red tape, not clinicians, just each other.
Representative Schoen has a question as well.
Madam Speaker and Madam Chair and Representative Abler.
It's late.
Yes. When I look at this in Stearns County, is it just because Stearns County is giving them guff? Or is it, if this was in my county, in Washington County, and it was, you know, 10 minutes away, would there not be a problem? Or is it the officials that are interpreting something here?
Well, Representative Abler?
It happens to be located in Stearns County. That's how we picked that name. It's in Sauk Center. It's an old abandoned DHS thing that was sold to a private person, and they're renting it from them. But if you want to hear about the bureaucracy issues, there's an expert here at the witness table.
No, Madam Chair. And
that's the issue.
Representative Abler. So, I mean, the same situation would happen if those buildings would have been in Washington or Ramsey or any other county. I mean, if you had set up here, we may be having the same discussion about whatever county it is. County
right,
it
yeah,
is.
That's it, yeah.
Representative Abler?
That's correct, Madam Chair. And Representative Schoen.
So, Madam Chair and Representative Abler, my only suggestion is, because this is downright awesome, you and I talked about this, I think, down when you were down in Cottage Grove on another issue.
Yeah.
So how do we make it so people can do this around the state rather than just Stearns County?
Well,
what if they want to expand or somebody else wants to do it?
Well,
I can
thank
answer
you.
Abler.
Well, actually, I got the answer he wants, but
I can answer you. We're way step ahead of you.
Yeah. Well, see, this is meant to be a stopgap. DHS is working on a GRH review anyway, and so they suggested we just keep it very narrow to affect just this site for now and this county. So as not to create all kinds of problems elsewhere. Just keep very narrow and focused. And so that was their suggestion. And hopefully it's still free. So that's where we'll find that out in finance.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Abler. Okay. All right. So Representative Abler is going to renew his motion that House File 2449 be re-referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee.
Oh, Madam Chair. Could I just have the veterans introduce themselves, just their names, and then that way they won't be named?
Sure, absolutely. Sorry about that. Thank you for recommending that. Yeah. Welcome.
Madam Chair and Committee, thank you for your time. My name is Todd Quica. I'm a medically retired veteran with five combat tours.
Welcome.
Madam Chair and Committee, my name is Chris Singer. I'm a 30-year retired National Guard with four deployments.
Madam Chair and Committee, my name is Daniel Klutenkamper. I only got three deployments, so I got some catching up to do.
Well, thank you,
gentlemen.
Thank
you, Madam Chair.
Thank you again for your service and for being here tonight. So all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the bill will go to Health and Human Services Finance. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Drive safely.
For the heroes.
The last bill on the calendar is House File 2458, Representative Allen. Welcome to the committee. Representative Allen is going to, let's see. Okay, Representative Allen can move her own bill. So she moves that House File 2458 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance.
Yes.
Okay.
And then I would also like to move an amendment.
Okay. Is that the A2 that's in the packet?
So yes.
Representative Allen moves the A2 to get the bill in the shape in which she'd like it discussed. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. Motion prevails. Okay. We're all set.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This bill is brought to me by the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless and the Legal Services advocacy project, and I'm sure they could name other stakeholders and other organizations that have worked on this bill, and I know there's been some press about it. And so as a solution to some of the problems with the definition of work activity under the MFIB statute. So I'll just remind the members what work activity means, and this is what we're amending here. Under the MFIB statute, work activity in general means any activity in a participant's approved employment plan that leads to employment. And there are currently 9 categories of activities that would qualify as work activity. And just to give you a little bit of history here, the program was previously called AFDC, as you know, and I just wanted to talk about that program and how it was a little different than the program we have now and how it relates to this bill. And that is the AFDC program. I was on that. My son was born in 1983, and I think I went on like from 85, and I went through college while receiving AFDC. And at that time, there were no barriers, no restrictions on my pursuing an education and getting a degree and then getting a job when I completed my 4-year degree, and then right after that going to law school. And I know today that would be sort of unheard of I'm not asking that everybody on MFIB can be allowed to go to law school, but back then there was no time limits on it. But the thing is that program, what that did for me was to ensure that I had a way to achieve self-sufficiency. I mean, it was that I credit that program and that the workers offering guidance and that I wasn't discouraged about pursuing education. And so that's what this bill is about here, is not advocating that we go back to that. The times have changed. This bill is about removing roadblocks, and it addresses 3 problems, and I'm going to briefly go over those 3 problems and then what this bill offers in a solution to those problems. And so that will, rather than just going through and reading you section by section of the bill. So what this bill, first thing it does, it allows participants the freedom to access adult basic education. Currently, 37% of adults on MFIB lack a high school diploma or GED, and the Twin Cities, the metro area, has one of the largest racial gaps in the nation when it comes to employment. And those without a high school or college degree are largely limited to minimum wage jobs. And so this offers a solution and allows MFIB participants to earn it adds to the there's the GED, and what this bill adds is that they will be able to participate in a Minnesota Adult Diploma Program. So that's one change. The second issue is removing a roadblock to post-secondary education, which I was talking to you about, my own experience. And this the problem here is that the current policy discourages parents from accessing educational opportunities. We know from our Living Wage Committee and Jobs presentation and from the department that by 2018, 70% of Minnesota jobs will require some education beyond high school. And also another statistic is that only 1.4% of adults on MFIB have a college degree. And that kind of struck me as why that was in there, and really that says to me that if you have a college degree, it's very unlikely that you're going to be needing MFIB, and that was in my case. I think since that time I've paid more taxes than I received in benefits easily. So the third problem this addresses is removing outdated barriers that limit self-sufficiency. In this case, nearly 70,000 Minnesotans turn to public assistance when they lose a job. And between 1979 and 2005, wages for those with college and advanced degrees rose 22% and 29%, while wages for high school graduates stagnated and those without high school degrees fell 16%. And so what we would like to address in this bill as a solution, address this problem and offer a solution, is to give new graduates the flexibility to job search for 12 weeks rather than 6 weeks. 6 weeks is what we have in the current statute. And then the last part of that is that we remove certain restrictions on the approval of English as a second language, English as a second language classes as a work activity. There's certain restrictions on it that you have to have a very low level of English proficiency in order to be able to take English only English second language classes, and this would remove that restriction completely. So I'm going to turn it over to the advocates to tell you some of the sort of policy and their experience with this issue.
Okay, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid, and we're supporting this bill because this really is the future of the Minnesota Family Investment Program. I am before this committee many times supporting increases in the cash grant and more infusion of funds to stabilize these families. This is the one thing we can do for these parents that can help them help themselves to get a living wage and to get a wage that will help them move off this program. Representative Allen really mentioned kind of our golden stats on this, but just to give you a sense, in Minnesota, a mom who has an 11th or 12th grade education, her median earnings are about $15,000 to $16,000. If she just steps through the college door, I mean, not even getting any kind of degree, just starting college, her median earnings jump up to $24,000 a year. It's almost $10,000. And by completing her AA, she's at $29,000, and then it just goes up from there. So this is something that we can never match by increasing the cash grant, right? I mean, this is something that we can really help people move off of this program and not look back. And when MFIP was conceived in the early 90s, Minnesota was so forward-thinking about education and training, and we had the STRIDE program, and we encouraged moms to get education and training and to kind of climb up the ladder. And really, sadly, the last 15, 20 years, we've lost our way. And we have been, it's nobody's fault. I mean, there's been federal guidance on this. There's been federal rule and requirement and law. There's been a state interpretation of that guidance. There's been a local interpretation of the state interpretation. And what that has meant is that county workers have been shoving moms into minimum wage jobs as fast and furiously as they can. And that means retail and temp jobs and unpaid work and job search. And we've been asking people to job search for 30 hours a week rather than putting them in a GED class for 30 hours a week. So we've just taken this huge step backward, and we've really lost a generation of moms, unfortunately, for education and training. But what we see over at DHS is a real commitment, even notwithstanding this bill, to new innovation in education and training, from Commissioner Justin to Aaron Sullivan Sutton to Mark Toogood and Jane DeLage. They are really looking for new innovative ways to put MFIT parents on these tracks. And so what this bill does is really complement those efforts and takes a lot of the restrictions and roadblocks out of statute and out of the program and says, let's let people pursue education and training, and let's encourage it and support it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Okay. Welcome.
What's your name?
Hi, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Catherine Wagoner. I work for the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. I'm a former director of the Affirmative Options Coalition, which recently merged with the Coalition for the Homeless. Before that, I worked in the MFIP Employment Services Program for about 8 years. And I can tell you that the workers are under enormous pressure to put people, and that's the words we use, put people in work activities, countable work activities, things much as count. I have to have at least half of my caseload doing a certain amount of either work or unpaid work or job search at all times. So letting people or allowing people to pursue GED or ESL, English as a Second Language, or post-secondary is pretty low priority on my list because it's kind of tough to just the basic rules that are really complicated are really tough. And we see we hear about the, it's called the Welfare to Work Program, but we kind of think that's a misnomer because people who are on welfare are not necessarily going to work. They're working already. They are workers. 80% of the folks on the program have been working recently or are working currently. But we talk about the skills gap where these companies don't have enough people to meet the needs of their work. And then we have this pool of workers that the workforce program that they're in kind of blocks them from going into those training programs. So we have these wonderful programs. We have Fast Track. We have the EJ Ajax is one example where he was and I saw an op-ed recently about that where they're working with Minsky and workers. But the pool of workers that we're talking about here when they go to their MFIP worker are really really discouraged from entering any of those things or not even told that it's an option. So I think in this bill it's kind of when someone doesn't have a high school diploma, it's mandatory that the worker would tell them that they are able to do that. We don't think everyone will. Obviously, it's not going to be forcing people to go get a GED. But there are people who would like to do that and are kind of discouraged from that because it doesn't count. Well, this will help it count. And then the worker has less pressure from their boss for not letting too many people do GED. So we're really here to have this pool of workers meet those needs of the state of Minnesota. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much. Are there questions? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I really support the direction of helping lift our families out of poverty because we know that has all kinds of benefits for the children. It has it takes away a lot of the stress in the home. It reduces dependency that can happen, go on for the whole rest of those children's lives till they become adults. And it has lots of great positive benefits. So I like the direction of this. The one thing that I think we need to think about a little bit more, and I'd be glad to work with you guys on thinking about how we could do that, is now that we have the federal lifetime 60 months, 5 years, we really have, you know, we have to do things in compressed time frames because these families only have so much opportunity, and so many people sometimes need another catch. At some point along that career trajectory, they may graduate at a time of a recession, and I have lots of people who have never been on MFIP who've got great degrees and great GPAs, and they can't find their way in right now, and so that those kids still need to be fed. And so I'm just wondering if we could need to strengthen the career exploration, career advising, you know, kind of creating that strategy because, you know, it's going to be hard for some of them to use up their time. You want to make sure they come out with the kind of programs that you're talking about that have, you know, living wage jobs and are good and that sort of thing. And we've cut back so much on the rest of our educational system that a lot of programs that used to be full-time are part-time, so that you could be in a GED or adult basic education or ELL program. And in some places, that's one night a week. And yet the time clock is running. And so we need to kind of figure out how to work with our educational partners to create, you know, kind of robust transition so that they can really move forward while the clock's running. And I'm not sure how to address that, but I do think the world has changed both in terms of the opportunities for education as well as the fact that the clock is always running.
Yeah. Representative Loeffler, it sounds like another bill.
Well, I'm actually wondering if we could strengthen the part that says, you know, they're going to meet with their employment counselor about the program and you know that will be going to finance, and that might just be adding some words that kind of says it's to be a plan for the remaining time they have on the 60 months, and you know assuring that they're being strategic.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, and you raise a lot of good points about and some of it is about increasing you know, the helping people find jobs and the right jobs and that getting the right training, and those are jobs sort of issues. But as far as this bill, you talked about making sure that the participants have guidance and that they're getting into programs that are going to, where there's likelihood that they'll be able to find a job in this current economy. And so that's what we, and I think those are some of the concerns that the department raised as well. And so that is what this amendment here, mm-hmm. We didn't talk about that, but what that's trying to address. And so that we don't, so that there is guidance provided, so that there's the worker is working with the participant to choose those programs to find what's suitable. So I'll let the advocate explain that a little bit better than I did.
Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, so my initial thought on this section was to just strike all the language about kind of the roadblocks and the restrictions that the worker take away the worker's control on that, and the department was really concerned that it would take away from kind of this partnership with the worker to look at what are good programs versus predatory programs. I think the department also might be interested about high interest private debt and those types of things. And so I think what you're talking about, though, is really fundamentally a training issue. And we are talking about fundamental culture change coming down from the Department of Human Services to the frontline counties, the training that's going to be provided to the county workers, the contracts that are going to go out for RFPs. I agree with you. I don't know if it's something that needs to be fully spelled out in statute. We don't do that for other programs like unemployment insurance or for other workers. And I feel like the Department of Human Services can really create a robust training program as they implement this statute in how to work with people best and how to match them up with the programs that are available in their counties.
Okay. Well, you know, this is going to finance, and mm-hmm. so there will be opportunity to talk offline further about this. And
yeah.
Another opportunity to offer an amendment if that's necessary or desired. So if there are no other questions, Representative Allen is going to renew her motion that House File 2458 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. And members,
thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Allen. And our next hearing is going to be Friday at 9 o'clock in this room. So with that,
Tina,
we are adjourned.